Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Lincoln Cast for the week of May the 10th, 2013. You're listening to the Giant Bomb Community's Guild Wars 2 podcast. My name is Thurbleton, and going around the table, I'm joined by self-confessed cynic.
What's up?
Hey,
I decided to go black with that. I'm sorry.
Much more enjoying this new intro music. It's very nice. Well done.
Oh, yeah. Oh, God. You are so going meta because we got here.
I'm forcing your hand.
No, it's definitely going to be there. It's definitely going to be there.
And then also around the table is Durin. How you doing?
I told you A was better than B.
A is not better. I don't know. It's hard to tell whether the A version of the new intro or B is better.
Crazy.
New Brahma, what was your choice on A to B?
I think I can diagnose Durin with a new disease called musical dyslexia, because you are doing a bad job at finding good music, Durin. It is clearly B.
I love how you guys are both arguing over, like, you had both musical theory rules on which, yep, like, your reason was better. Yep. Shimboy, how are you doing today?
I'm gonna spell this out for you. The reverse arpeggios in B sounded good on their own, but they didn't flow well with the rest of the piece.
Someone agree, because I did, because what I did was I got the same one piece of music, and then I cut it to be a bit more energetic for a bit. Even talking about this, what are we even
I don't
doing?
Know. You cut it. You guys are arguing over like four channels of music. It's 8-bit. last person on the podcast, actually, I think he's the one who helped create the intro music that we're using. Josh Foreman, how you doing today?
Great.
Nice.
Energy.
That was,
I like it.
Like the Wonderful. Least informative intro for the special guest who this entire episode is devoted for I've ever heard.
Josh Foreman of ArenaNet, environment designer. How are you doing today?
Super great.
There we go.
Oh, okay.
Super good choice of words.
Nice.
I guess I want this to be as short a long podcast as possible, so we're just going to jump into the first topic. For folks who don't know, who are listening to this our podcast for the first time, we usually talk about what we've been playing either at the beginning or we mix it in.
Yep.
But we're going to skip the part where all of us hosts talk, and we're just going to find out what Josh has been playing lately. So, Josh,
And before that, I will note that I will be putting in the show notes as to when we actually start talking about Guild Wars 2. Do not expect us to talk about Guild Wars 2 for like the first 30 to 45 minutes. I'm just going to put that out
say,
there.
If the last episode is any indication.
Well, really, the last episodes are an indication.
Hopefully, yeah. Less Hobbit talking will be found here.
I won't talk about Star Trek, but we'll see.
What you been up to?
Oh, me?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So, games. Recently, I've been going back through my collection and trying to wrap up loose ends. Like, finally got through Skyrim.
Nice.
Oh, wow. That is an accomplishment.
I think I had almost 200 hours in it.
Holy cow.
And this is why I will never finish that game.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't have to take that long. I just never paid attention to the main quest.
So, well, no, actually, but I will. And so,
by saying that you finished it, do you mean you actually did end up going up and finishing the main quest? Or
yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Because looking at our previous discussions on this podcast, you being really into environments, that game is almost endless when it comes to new environments and stuff. Holy cow!
Sure. Yeah, it's great. It's really. That word where you feel inspired. That's the word.
Yeah.
Inspired. Yes.
What's your favorite part of
talking
Skyrim?
About being... Oh, never mind. Go ahead.
Oh, my favorite part. I really like it when they do the what they call kit bashing, where they take a couple different, you know, like the mossy, wet cave, and they mix it in with the dwarven architecture or whatever. That's pretty fun.
Where did that... What? I've never heard that word before. Kit bashing?
Oh, okay.
You're just not in the industry, isn't it?
Yeah, what's happening?
all their dungeons are split up into basically like Lego chunks, right? And they could put a hallway here and a room there. And they just... So they call those kits. So they have the dwarf... I forget what they call the dwarves, right? They have that kit. They have the generic dungeon kit. They have the... snow cave kit.
It's almost like a modular design of like, we can add this hallway and chunk it together. It's almost, some would say, like the story dungeon that you probably haven't played yet, Cynic.
Oh, boom. All right.
For the living story.
Hey,
anyway,
so
that's Guild Wars 2. We're going to skip that for now. Going back to Skyrim.
Yeah, so it's neat to see how far they can push their modular technology and stuff. And it's fun.
That is cool.
Yeah, because I remember watching, like, right when they were about to release the creation kit, like, to modders, they were talking about how all of the dungeon environments were modular. So they just had one of the guys in, like, a short little video go over and go, okay, we're going to take this hallway and this big like square room from these two completely different sets, and you link them together, and if you just maneuver it just right, it'll mesh like perfectly. So it's a real smart way to make like environments both easy to make, and the ones that are easy to make also still look really good.
Nice. Mm-hmm. And it's also crazy because it's ceaselessly interesting to me asking Josh what his favorite part about a game is, because when I think of Skyrim, it's like I think of that time where I was fighting a dragon on top of a keep, and I was just like snowing, and I jumped onto his back and then stabbed him in the back of the head. And Josh is like, yeah, I like the blending of their modular set design. I'm like, oh my god.
I don't know. But still, are you an abuser of the development console or developer console, Josh? Do you like to use the developer console?
Do you find times like, wow, this fight is a little bit difficult. I'm going to hit dev and turn on god mode and then summon a bunch of dragons to my aid.
That sounds pretty okay.
No, I play completely by the book, to be honest.
Good for you.
In developing, you're constantly doing that, and it's just not really fun.
I quit Skyrim and picked it up many times because I could not hold myself back from cheating. That's probably not a good indication of me.
So Josh, do you play with mods or do you just play stock?
I have it on Xbox. So
nice.
Oh no.
Okay.
Nice. No, I'm actually a totally stock guy because I love seeing what the developer's vision was for a game, at least my first time through it.
Yeah, I think the only mods I actually use on mine were like aesthetic stuff. Like I use like a depth of field mod and things like realistic lighting mod, things like that, but like nothing that actually directly affected gameplay because I'm kind of that way as well.
The only ones that I really use are like, doesn't really change what things are, but say just like a higher res texture. Yeah. Something like load signs, easier to read and stuff. And then
I think I really would have liked, I'm sure they have one, I don't know if they do, but one that, doesn't alphabetize, but puts your potions in,
Yep.
Oh, yes, there is the Sky UI mod.
Sky UI is fantastic. Yes, it sources the UI. And it has like a search function in your inventory. It's amazing.
It fixes it. Let's just be clear. It fixes that terrible,
broken ass. For a controller... For a controller, that UI is actually really nice.
But it's unordered. It's like totally weird way of viewing your stuff. I know like navigating it is good, but getting to the stuff you want when you want it isn't exactly...
So as far as other games, because you guys are out of my league now. So the other thing I've been doing is just... I don't want to say research, but it's kind of like that, where I just want to see all the various new mechanics that kind of the smaller games out there. I'm loath to use the word indie, but games with smaller dev teams that are focused on one particular new mechanic, like FTL and Fez and Super Meat Boy and Unfinished Swan, Mark of the Ninja, that kind of stuff.
Have you played all of those already?
I actually just wrote that down because I saw your question there, so I wrote down all the ones I've recently been playing through.
Because my question about Fez is, did you play Fez or did you play Fez?
Meaning, did you get into like all the crazy, like, what does this mean?
There's
nonsense.
Two games in Fez.
Almost in like a Room 237 sense of like trying to overanalyze everything about every like cell of a frame of a like shot.
Well, to be fair, like there are two games in Fez. There's the first time you go through, which is just like a normal platformer that's really easy. And then you realize that, holy crap, there's like a sub game. And it's like all deep stuff.
Okay, so I got to that part. I'm still playing through the first section of it. And I enjoyed the meta commentary that all the little NPCs are spouting and stuff like that. But
that's great.
But he hasn't gotten to Fez yet then.
Yeah, he hasn't gotten to Fez. Because Josh... It's great that I was able to at least get you in this, because you may not have realized it, but I'm not sure how much you've read into Fez, but there's a particular point in Fez that if you observe the correct thing, you realize that everything you've played so far is just like the top layer of that game, and there's so much more beyond that.
That's exciting. I'm glad you hear that.
I hope you get into it. It's going to be awesome.
And again, more or less made by just one crazy Canadian.
Yeah. French Canadian, not a real Canadian, by the way.
I'm sorry.
Oh.
I saw that indie game, the movie, and he did not come off well in that.
I am not a big fan of Phil Fish.
I don't know. Like they had him on Giant Bomb during, I think it was GDC.
He seems like a cool guy.
And he actually seemed pretty okay there. I think.
Yeah.
The stress and everything.
I would never say he's a good or bad. I'm just saying on that film, he did not
come off well. No, not at all.
For the record, Indie Game the Movie is a high quality film that everyone should watch.
I agree.
I'd say that. Yeah, definitely.
So of those games, which have you found the most fun?
Fun. Well, I'm most addicted to FTL.
FTL?
Yeah, a lot of people are addicted to FTL.
Yeah. It's a weird thing because I've never got into the roguelike in the fantasy genre. I mean, fantasy is kind of my de facto go-to genre for anything, but I've never really liked roguelikes. And then last year, I fell in love with Spelunky, which is a roguelike platformer, and then this year, a roguelike space sim. So, yeah, I don't know what the deal is.
The only roguelike platformer, like, to anybody who's listening, it's also really fun with just a group of people. So if you have friends at the office or, like, if you're family or something, you like to play games. Like, that's, from what I've heard, it's a lot of fun, co-op.
Was Spelunky?
Is it Spelunky or FTL?
Spelunky.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was my favorite game last year.
I was going to say that it's cool with other people, unless those other people are, like, my friends or the Giant Bomb Crew or, you know, anyone who will grief you or just
troll.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Well, then it's still fun, just not for one person.
Come play FTL on the PC Gaming Hub.
It's the same kind of fun that, like, you know, New Super Mario Brothers multiplayer is fun.
Yeah.
If just hate yourself.
Anyway, I guess sort of steering towards this question, during the last podcast, you talked about how much you like playing BioShock. Have you finished it yet?
Yeah.
BioShock the first.
The one that I finished. Yeah.
Oh, so you have... Oh, no, okay. Because I really wanted to do the follow-up question as to whether you finished Infinite or not. Have you finished Infinite?
I haven't started that one yet.
Oh, no.
Oh, man. I have since the last time you were on the show, I have since finished both BioShock 1 and BioShock Infinite. And I actually really enjoyed 1. I thought it held up really well, especially from, like, an art point of view.
Yeah.
Like, the way a lot of the lighting works, and what the hell is the guy's name? The theater level... Where you have to is it Fort Frog? Where you have to go take the pictures of all the dude's subjects?
I think so.
Yeah, because I was iffy on the game until it got to that point, and they really started to use the lighting, especially with the spotlights following you around in the main atrium and everything. And I was like, okay, I can see what the big deal was with this game. And it really clicked from there.
My question would be what did you finally take away from BioShock? Like, there's the twist ending and all that kind of stuff, but I'm suspecting you didn't. Necessarily, that isn't your only observation with BioShock.
Wait,
Josh, specifically.
Okay, I was like, what?
I don't care about you, Shinboy.
Oh.
I care about Shinboy. What did I take away? I really like that it was such a boilerplate genre piece, but within that, there was so much room for creativity that you don't see in most of those kind of games. And that's inspiring to me, is to take a trope-laden, you know, experience and put enough twists and bumps that make it interesting and feel new and fresh, even though the mechanics aren't new and fresh at all.
Yeah, I was going to say that actually is really similar to some of the games you've been playing recently, because, like, you have, what's his face, Mark of the Ninja, which essentially just reinvents stealth, in my opinion. Totally changes up. Do you enjoy the way that they do stealth in that game?
Yeah, well, to see, it's kind of it feels unfair to me because there's so many stealth-based games that are in 3D.
Yeah,
that fall short of it, but it's because they're in 3D, and it's so much harder to do.
I'm so glad I didn't just say Guild Wars 2.
You know, the best stealth game.
But no, yeah, I totally agree, because by removing that third element, you can have stuff like pots being hide, like you can hide behind a pot, and it would make complete sense from that 2D plane. But if you try to do that in the 3D space, it just doesn't work at all, because it creates a dissonance with the player.
What about like in Skyrim, where you put the pot over their head, and then you're invisible?
Now, on the subject of 3D stealth game, did you ever play Dishonored, or have you looked into that at all?
Yeah, I started Dishonored. I really wanted to like it. I probably put in about 6 hours into it.
Yep.
And I kind of felt the opposite as I did about BioShock, where it's all of these familiar elements and they're all done really well,
mm-hmm.
and they're all cohesive, and it's should be a great game, and it just didn't grab me for whatever reason. Even though I love steampunk, I love the aesthetic. I think first person stealth in 3D game, I don't know, just didn't grab me.
Nice. No, I totally.
It's actually really interesting because Shinboy and I were actually having a conversation about just that this afternoon. And I don't know if you played Far Cry 3 at all by chance?
No.
Okay. It's interesting because actually one of the things we both agreed on, because he actually didn't care for Dishonored and I thought it was great, specifically the stealth elements, was that Far Cry 3, not being a stealth game at all, actually has probably some of the best first-person 3D stealth in any game ever. They did such a great job of allowing the player to feel kind of like that you know, badass ninja guy hiding out in the tall grass. And I think a lot of what helped with that you know, Dishonored just isn't capable of doing, just given the design of the environments, is that with Far Cry 3, you have kind of a big open area. Like, say you're like attacking like an outpost or something, you have a big open area that the player can kind of move around in and plan their attack and so on. Whereas with like Dishonored and a lot of other you know, first-person 3D stealth games, it's a little bit more, I don't want to say corridor-based, but it's a lot narrower areas, a lot less area for the player to kind of maneuver around in and get a good kind of bird's-eye view or even just you know, a 360 view of the area and kind of plan that attack out.
Yeah, I'll check it out. I love the idea of stealth, and I love the idea of finding a place where it's implemented well. I just haven't yet.
Yeah, if that's the case, I would totally recommend Far Cry 3 and then just limit yourself to the bow.
Oh, the bow. It's like, or if you don't want to spend all the money and you want something that is equally fun but double the dumb, you get Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon, because it's basically Far Cry 3, but if it were a dumb 80s action movie.
Yep.
That sounds like what's the one with the scorpion wire where you pull yourself up to jet planes and then...
Just Cause.
Well, yeah, except with Far Cry Blood Dragon, it's actually, when it's like a dumb 80s action movie, it's a dumb 80s sci-fi B action movie.
Yeah, you play like a cyber commando, basically.
There's a button really for dumb. Pulling.
Is it a mod or what?
No, it's a
standalone deals, like standalone expansion.
Standalone expansion thing. Yeah. It's like $15.
Yeah. That's cool. To give you an idea of like the tone of it, there's a button for pulling the one finger salute, and that's the kind of that's everything about that game.
It's like, having played Blood Dragon, that's just the melee button when you're not in range of meleeing people.
Yeah, not to mention you do it with your robo arm.
Yeah, well, you can. Yeah. Does it alternate? I think it alternates. You can do the Homer. Yeah. God damn it! That game looks so cool.
But yeah, I mean, it also has, you know, dragons that shoot lasers. So.
Excuse me, blood dragons that shoot lasers. Sorry.
Blood dragons.
Yeah. All right, moving on. Another game you're curious whether or not you played. Yeah, go ahead, Cynic, you want to ask it.
Because every time Josh speaks, I have like a million more questions. So you like the idea of stealth games. Have you played some of like the classic ones, like Metal Gear Solid?
Yeah, sure.
You mean Thief, if you mean classic stealth games.
Wait, which game? I think Metal Gear came before Thief.
I have played Thief 1. Or was it Thief 2? I think it was Thief 2. And Metal Gear Solid.
What are your thoughts on Metal Gear?
Gear Solid is third person, so it's easier and better to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's true. Wait, hold on. Speaking of Thief 2 and Bioshock, wasn't Thief 2 another Ken Levine joint?
Yes.
Okay.
But he barely touched that. I remember him being on the show when they were talking about Thief, and he like barely... He didn't do too much work on Thief. So he gets spicy.
When I worked at Outrage and we were working on Descent 3, I mean, that's when he was kind of in his prime, and we were definitely looking at a lot of games like that. I mean, when we were looking at, you know, spaceship stealth mechanics, we were looking at Bioshock, or not, what's the one that, System Shock.
System right? Shock, yeah.
Yeah, System Shock too.
Nice.
Was Metro 23's like stealth intentional, or because I always felt like when I played it, I could never successfully get through the area stuff.
I have not played that game.
It's not very stealth heavy. I think
it's just you turn off lights and that.
Yeah, it's hard to go through the entire game without fighting, because they throw you into fighting.
You know what's a good first person stealth game or has stealth in it? Human Revolution. Deus Ex. That actually has decent stealth in it.
If the boss fights weren't terror bad, then yeah, it'd be good.
Yeah.
I've got that on my stack. I own it. I haven't played it yet.
You'll probably love it because their image of, like, they did a really good job of kind of combining the 80s view of the future, like the Blade Runner-y kind of view of the future, and also like a new modern twist on it, because it's still Asian dominated, that kind of stuff. But in the 80s, when we thought about Asian dominated futures, it was a very different thing to how we think about it today. So they kind of did a really good job of just meshing those two. And I would love to hear.
Yeah, the difference between Japan and China.
I guess. Exactly. Difference between that and like different catalysts for why that future came to be and how that affects the world. I thought like the world building in Human Revolution was one of the best in recent
times. The only thing that bothers me is that I took a helicopter flight from Detroit to Shanghai in that game. I don't think that's a thing that would happen.
Well, helicopters. It's a future helicopter.
That helicopter had jets. It had jets.
I mean, I guess.
All right, I guess we'll just move on to the main topic, Pseudo Guild Wars. Josh Foreman, I hear you helped make the Super Adventure Box.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Is that rumor true? Can you confirm or deny that?
I think I'm allowed to say that I worked on it.
Okay.
Perhaps retro game you were working on that you wanted to hint at at a previous interview?
Yeah, perhaps.
Yeah. So... You want the spiel? I think I can answer several of the questions that are there just in one kind of synopsis.
Sure.
Okay, so this is how it went down. I'm working on the Halloween Mad King jump puzzle, and I'm like, yeah, okay, so that was the first time we put a jumping puzzle in its own map, which meant there were all sorts of things we didn't have to be concerned with that you have to when it's in a regular map, and then it occurred to me, why don't we have a jumping puzzle dungeon? That would be so great. And then I just went, because I've been so influenced by the classic, like, Miyamoto type games. I mean, all through all the jumping puzzles I've done, this is where I should do it.
Right.
So and it started out, so the way ArenaNet is set up right now is we have, you know, our various Living World teams, and then we got our World Be World team, PvP team, et cetera, et cetera, right? But then we also have this other kind of, it's called base camp. And it's basically where people don't have a specific goal per se. It's kind of like our R&D division. And so I got thrown into there. You know, I pitched my idea to a couple people, you know, Colin and Izzy and Dave B. And I said, that sounds like an interesting idea. And so... I got to go to base camp and just start develop. Well, after we wrapped up the Winter's Day stuff, and so just started kind of working on that with one or two other people, and the goal was always to have base camp kind of be this little incubator for interesting, innovative ideas that will weave into the future of Guild Wars, right? Okay, kind of to get that indie scene, bootstrap sort of. You know, hey, we're just this tiny little team and we've got this little vision and we're going to try to make it happen. And so we were the first team that really got promoted from that. That was always their idea was, you know, people generate these ideas, they work on it for a little bit. If it looks like it's got promise, then they kind of say, okay, great, let's make this a real thing. And so once that happened, they added a couple more people to the team, like a producer, that kind of stuff. And at the end, we're 8 people, including producer. And so that's kind of how that happened.
in short, oh, okay, let's just like quickly rearrange our questions because I got through. It's really because I'm up first, right? Because we're going to be doing questions in segments. I'm the first segment, followed by Durin, then Thurbleton, then Shinboy. So I get to have the first whack. So... You were the lead? Is that correct? Am I crazy here? Did I mishear all of that? Or did you are a lead on Super Adventure Box?
I think it was more so like, if I'm understanding correctly, you just said like, hey, can I go to this base camp, aka just a big sandbox area, work on this, and then you come back like, whoa, this is really looking into something. This is like some cool. The higher up said, oh, okay, here's a team of people. You're in charge of stuff now.
Yeah.
And it Yeah. Was that like, did it feel like a weight had been put on your shoulders? Like I'm now responsible for something almost, or
a little bit. I mean, it was still small enough where it was not that big a deal. I always wanted to keep our footprint really small. I mean, at first it was just to avoid being noticed so that we could do whatever the hell we wanted. Right. and then at some point, you know, we had to be like, oh, hey, important people, look what we're working on. And at that point, you know, we got more resources and stuff, but it was still small enough where, you know, technically I was a coordinator is what they're called. And the idea is that's the vision holder who kind of keeps everything going on a coordinated path.
Right.
I guess.
Nice.
So, yeah. And it wasn't really, you know, it didn't turn me into a producer or a lead or anything like that. It was just, you know, I'm making these levels and now I've got a scripter helping me and now I've got a prop guy helping me and now I've got a programmer, you know,
okay,
that sort of thing.
So, I kind of want to throw these questions to you because one of the first things I wanted to ask was at what point did, say, am I saying these names correctly, McLean Damer and Fyfe Chapelle? Is that right? The composers of the... Sorry?
I said, no, that's not right at all.
Good job,
did I completely screw up those names? Is that...
Well, yeah, that's okay. So
you'll have to forgive his Australian English. It's sometimes chopped up.
McLean is our in-house musician, and Leif is a content designer. But he also has a degree from some prestigious musical university.
Nice.
I don't remember which.
And so what then? So that they got involved because I absolutely cannot stop listening to the Super Adventure Box music.
Isn't it amazing? I think it absolutely holds up to the best like that came out of Capcom and Konami.
Yeah. It's great.
It's shocking to me.
it is incredibly good.
So yeah, I mean, we just have good musicians here. You know, Leif just kind of did it on weekends and evenings just because he did chip tunes to begin with anyway, and that's just kind of a passion of his.
Nice. Wait, so were you part of that creation process? Or did you just go, all right, I'm going to make the music for this? And you were like, okay.
You know, I wanted to be, I tried to be, I sent them all my little demo tapes of, you know, little music that I've made, and they ignored it all, which is probably better.
So there was no, like, you going, looking at them and going, no, this isn't good enough, go back to it.
No. Well, I mean, I created a document for them outlining each of the zones and the mood that I wanted to communicate, and then, you know, they took it from there. And I mean, every time they brought something back, I was like, this is 20 times better than I thought it would be, good job, you know.
Yeah, no, because I was just listening to an interview with the guy Makier from Thomas Was Alone. You probably haven't heard of it, but he was talking about how he just started working with a dude straight out of college for the soundtrack of that. And how it kind of went down was he was like, okay, here are my ideas. These are just like general scoping of ideas and like pictures that would somehow evoke what he was looking for the soundtrack. And the dude would just come back to him and he would just start crying with how good the stuff was coming back with. But like his like summary of that was he's impressed with some game makers as to their ability to not accept that and actually have criticism and so forth. Like one of my favorite things recently is if you finish Bioshock Infinite, in the credits you see Ken Levine talking with the guys who end up singing pretty much the major song for that game, which is Will the Circle Be Unbroken. And he's sitting there and he's put under like the really interesting and crazy circumstance of talking to these like really talented artists and going, so that was amazing, but I kind of want it like this instead.
And yeah, it was funny. It's more like that was amazing. I kind of want it not quite as amazing. just bring it down.
It's funny. It's funny. He's like, that was too professional.
That's Lucas's technique, right?
That explains everything.
Oh man, shots fired.
Well, okay, so there were two, I think, two particular sounds in the music that I was like, is that really 8-bit? That doesn't really sound, but that was so minor, and it wasn't.
Your brain was just like, this would sound better if it sounded worse.
So it's kind of like you guys set up an indie studio within ArenaNet is what this is sounding like.
Yeah, well, it's really exciting. That's kind of how we're working the whole Living World system is following the indie game model too. I mean, to an extent, obviously, right. We're all part of a company. We have healthcare and that yeah. kind of stuff. So, but
you're not so taking out loans,
right? But yeah, we have a lot of power given to us, and we're trusted with that. You know, and we've got several kind of gates that we go through where, you know, Colin and Izzy and Mike Z will come and check out what you're doing and say, steer it this way or that way. But I mean, for the most part, we're really left to our own devices, and that's really cool.
So my follow-up question would be, and I swear I wrote this down somewhere, but I can't see it on this cell sheet anymore, so I might have accidentally deleted it. So from start to finish, and this is like going to be one of those grognard questions, from start to finish, what was the actual, how did Super Adventure Box happen in terms of like internal development? Did you start with the levels, or did you start with this like concept art, or and what at what point did other people start chipping in? Because you were kind of like the genesis of this. So what was the overall?
Okay, so step one was I wrote up a vision document that right. was about a page. No, it was probably like two or three paragraphs, really, and emailed it to, you know, the environment lead, to Colin, to Chris Whiteside, or producer of producers, and said, here's an idea. And like I said, they threw me in Basecamp and said, go for it. Now Basecamp has several artists, a couple animators, a variety of different disciplines, right? So the environment lead, Dave B, he was like, he kind of looked at who was in Basecamp, what the proclivities were, and there's another guy there who built, he's more on the prop side, and he's super into retro gaming, right? So right. I was like, good fit. So he threw him on my team. I specifically asked for Lisa, because I've worked with her a couple times in the past. And
what does she do?
She's a content designer.
Okay.
So she's the one who makes it actually work.
Right. Okay.
Makes yep. bounce, mushrooms bounce you and lets you have, you know, hearts instead of a health bar and all that kind of stuff.
Nice.
Oh, so she's the one who made that like really awesome retro UI.
No, I did the UI. Well, okay. I did the art for the UI. Our programmer made it so that we could mod the current UI. And then Lisa has to script it so that when you go into Super Adventure Box, you're basically given all these buffs and transforms and whatever so that it applies to your character.
Oh, cool.
Okay, that makes sense as right. a unit. That seems like yeah. a good idea.
So yeah. it was us three for a while, and then we got an animator who's also into retro stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it was a great just confluence of people that all had the same passion, and they were directed towards each other by a you know, a leadership structure that has a clue what they're doing. So it's really cool.
And so what kind of timeline were you talking about that? Like, how long did that team take to come together?
The four of us were almost within 1 week of me coming into Basecamp. The four of us got together and we started having meetings for about a week. Maybe 2 weeks, you know, not nothing but meetings, but we would meet and then we'd try to make a little something and then we'd meet again. And, you know, it's basically just going over all of our memories of you know, 8 and 16 bit games and what we really liked about them, what we disliked about them. Should we include the stuff that we dislike because that's such a vital factor in what they feel like?
I need examples. What did you not like? That is so interesting.
Well, I mean, the first obvious thing about an 8-bit game is that it's super difficult because they couldn't make, you know, a 6-hour experience where you just progress from A to B. You have to die over and over and over and over.
Yeah.
And the question was, do we want to go that way? You know, and in a lot of ways, because we're such a small team, we had very similar limiting factors. You know, we can't make a game that's as long as, you know, Uncharted or whatever and let yeah. you just blow through it. So some of those things, you know, not having continues or a limited amount of continues, I mean, when I first came up with the idea, we were thinking of it more like an arcade game paradigm where you would actually purchase coins.
I knew
you
know, it. I was going to ask. Like, it was quarters a thing.
Yeah. And we were like, can we actually make it cost a quarter every time? And, you know, that just kind of went against the overall ArenaNet, you know, right. Guild Wars 2 philosophy.
Like, it seemed more like an arcade game that was then transferred to, like, an at-home console, not to quote the trailer you guys did, which was hilarious. But it's almost like continues were, like, a joke thing. You could easily get back in.
Right.
But it's, you still had that fear of like, dying or whatnot and then having to start from the beginning, but it wasn't as hard to restart.
Yeah. So there was that, and then there was the things I'm trying to think of other things that we all hate about I'm sure you guys will remind me. I mean, we had a very long list.
That's totally cool. No, I was because we can probably go on. So that was like what, 3 weeks already? So you're past scoping and with general ideas on the table of what you want to put together?
Yeah, I'd say the first 2 or 3 weeks was that, and then the aesthetic, like getting the aesthetic established and approved. And that was actually a really big process because there were several things we were trying to stay away from, several things we were trying to go towards.
Uh-huh.
For instance, we didn't want to make it look like Minecraft, and still, every time anyone goes in, they're like, "Oh, it's a Minecraft!"
I can't think of anyone, especially on this podcast, who would think that.
I think it's just an unfortunate thing you're going to run into when you try to do like an 8-bit style in a 3D world, though.
Yeah,
and that's exactly. We're both 3D games referencing an 8-bit game, so you can't totally escape that. But we tried several different methods to make an 8-bit world in a 3D game. And one of them was like almost literally Minecraft. Like everything was made out of the same size cubes. And we tried a variety size of cubes to where it was more kind of a voxely world. But then we had all these kind of curves and stuff that we weren't happy with. So we basically established this rule of all 90s and 45 degree angles.
Okay.
And that really helped to guide.
Now that you've mentioned that, I'm really hoping you guys do a voxel one at some point.
maybe just a hidden voxel area, but like it's the majority. Like it's something I'm curious about, especially with. I'm not sure if this is a question. I'm sorry if I'm jumping in on it, but with the whole infantile mode, and we can like discuss that later. You're having to make a set path, and that sort of reduces the ability for folks going on that method to see all the little nooks and crannies you guys threw in there.
Yeah.
Like the hidden areas, the side paths. Did that bug you, or did you guys not worry about it because there weren't a whole lot to begin with? Did you want to add a lot more side areas?
Well, I mean, one of the very first reasons I wanted to do a jumping puzzle dungeon was because I wanted to have variable difficulties.
Right.
Because I know a lot of people don't like jumping puzzles and they just skip over them. So the idea of having an easy mode is that you actually include more people, you know, and they may get 20% of the experience that someone who does regular mode gets, but that's more than 0% of the experience.
I'm going to say, Josh, that I did it and only in infantile mode, and I thought you did a fantastic job. Yeah, I got, me and Nubarama were able to go through that whole jumping puzzle on, like, because we didn't barely have time anymore. Nubarama doesn't. So we were able to jump in and just, like, walk over all the difficult stuff and point to it. Oh yeah, I can see why that would suck, and then just keep walking.
Exactly. Yeah.
I also have to say, like, kudos to you guys for calling it infantile mode.
Yeah.
Well, first it was we were calling it baby mode, and
infantile mode just sounds way more poetically insulting.
Yeah.
Yeah. We got our writer Peter Fries, and he's got a very sly sense of humor and understands the Silvar, or sorry, the Asura really well. And you know, that was his take on it. This is what an Asura teacher would consider this mode, right?
That's great. So so was the infantile mode part of that first, like, did you guys like sit down at the table and go, okay, when you were scoping out this project, did you go, okay, we want multiple difficult levels from the start, or did that kind of evolve as you went into it? And did everyone agree?
No, it was from the start, for sure. Three modes were planned from the start, and we had to cut hard mode at near the end of the project, just because we found out near the end that we were kind of doing it an expensive way, where it was constantly hounding the server for you know, technical reasons.
Yep.
And so we had to kind of put that on the back burner till next release.
Oh, okay. So so you guys are actually planning for a hard mode?
Yeah.
What's absolutely the difference? Like, what do you actually put in there to make it more difficult?
Okay, so there's two basic ways you can make something more difficult, which is just increasing. Okay, I guess there's three ways.
And there's a couple. These
kind
are
of a philosophical debate that we have amongst our team is how we want to approach it. But I mean, there's take everything that's already there and just, you know, make the bad guys' hit points higher, make them hurt you more,
right?
You know, make the jumps a little further. Add a time pressure, that sort of thing, where it's basically the same thing, but just ratchet it up a little bit. And then the other one is to just to handicap the player, which is, you know, make it so you only have one life, you know, blah, blah, blah. And that's still essentially keeping things the same. The direction I really wanted to go that's most interesting to me, I don't know if you've ever played I Want to Be the Guy.
Yes.
Or...
Yep.
The predecessor to that, which I can never remember the actual Japanese name, but it's kind of known as Cat Mario, was the first one I played like that, where it's a spoof of Mario and things just completely randomly kill you for no reason, and it just becomes kind of a muscle memory thing.
So if anybody doesn't know, a modern successor would be Super Meat Boy.
To a certain
That's definitely an easier version of it, but yeah.
Well, Super Meat Boy isn't capricious in the same way, where it will, you know, something that's normally a power-up will now kill you, or something in the back.
It's not trying to trick you. Like,
I'll say, the good thing that I really like about Super Meat Boy is that it's tough, but if you die, you know why you died.
Right.
Yeah. That's the best kind of game. That's why I love Spelunky so much, was every time I died, I was laughing out loud at myself.
Mm-hmm.
Or Dark Souls.
Oh, I missed time
then. When you die in Dark Souls, you know exactly why you died.
Yeah, that's another great example.
Which is awesome.
So that kind of hard mode, the one where it's just capricious and weird and unexpected, that's the one that I was going for. So
like a glitch, as if the game glitched.
Almost.
Nice.
So like the pointy arrow hands, for instance, that guide the way, in hard mode, they rocketed towards you and killed you, you know, that sort of thing.
That sounds so cool. Thurbleton, as the resident jumping puzzle dude, does that sound cool to you?
Yes.
He says with a sly smile on his face.
Yeah. So,
no, it is a straight up grin.
Yeah. It's a lot of trial and error, like very purposeful, very like kind of a... It's almost like a mean playfulness to a certain extent. It's a different way of the developer to communicate with the player. And we have our QA principal on the project is really into super hard stuff. Like I asked for him specifically on Super Adventure Box because he walked through my Mad King clock tower like his third or fourth try or something.
Nice.
And so he's just incredible. And he's totally into that kind of masochistic, like throw yourself against a brick wall 100 times, and so yeah, we're going towards that. The idea is like, at some point you will build up 99 lives in Super Adventure Box, and you'll be like, now what do I do? And the answer is hard mode, and you will eat through those lives super fast.
But would you get more? Like, is your idea to have to reward the player way more on that mode, or do you just want to have it hard for the sake of like enjoyment and not really about rewards and so on and so forth?
Yeah, I mean, we have to be careful about how we reward things that require specific things, such as a good, you know, ping and a fast computer and, you know, so stuff that's are limited through no fault of their own. But on the other hand, yeah, I mean, we can certainly give acknowledgement, like, you did something great. My ideal thing would be to give, like, we actually created a, you know, the frog boss at the end. We created a little rotating crown that you could wear if you beat hard mode, but we cut hard mode so you won't have that. So, you know, something like that, or a mini pet that's exclusive to people who have beaten on hard mode or whatever. Something like that.
Right, because it's interesting to me, because as a person who doesn't really go into games for the hard mode, like, I'm I've started playing
we're
games and
tourists in it.
Yeah, a content tourist like Gary Witter. I started playing games on easy this year, and I don't want to. I don't think I'll go back. I just really like just experiencing things for the sake of experiencing things, just to see everything that's in it, or at least have touch on stuff that is in it. So, from your perspective, what's the balancing act between putting content in for rewards versus putting content in for the experience? Because a lot of players would go, okay, if hard mode is the only way to get X, then I have to do X, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really interesting issue. I always approach things from an experience perspective, and I just don't care about the rewards, and that has to be balanced by, you know, because 90% of the people playing, you know, you see it on the forums, like, I have no reason to play this because there's no rewards.
Right.
So
it's like, well, how about it's fun? Is that a good reason?
So, yeah, figuring out how the reward structure works, right, and how it both honors the, you know, kind of the vision of the experience versus how it fits in with the overall economy and player expectations. It's a very complex equation.
And do you have any input on that, or is that more like someone else's problem?
Well, what I try to do is I try to represent my perspective as, you know, coming from the experience angle and saying this is what we want to provide. And then obviously you have to be open and receptive to the other, you know, pressures that are there to reward people who want to be rewarded in ways they want to be rewarded.
So right.
I don't think we were completely successful with getting both of those goals this first time, and I think we're going to be a lot better at it this second time. Now that we've been through the process and we have a better idea of what Super Adventure Box is and all the other teams, you know, the economy team and, you know, everyone else has a sense of what we're trying to accomplish, I think we'll have a lot better solution.
At the risk of spoiling things for the future, are there any hints you want to give us as to things you're like looking down toward, like for the next Super Adventure Box?
Oh, it's the next release is going to be World 2, which is the mountains, right? I mean, we purposely put a little spoiler, you know, here's a sample for what's coming.
But in terms of rewards, or is there anything you want to hint at?
Yeah, we haven't even had those discussions yet. I mean, we've kind of talked a little bit here and there, but just as Super Adventure Box team, not with Izzy and you know, the other people who really have to weigh in on it.
I guess a question I'd have for you is it easier or more streamlined this time around, or is it once again more or less starting from scratch? Like, did you have like World 2, like, you know, the first half planned out when you guys were doing the roundtable meeting sort of things, or is it okay? Like, now we have to get some of those ideas, but we still have to figure out what we're doing with all of this.
Yeah, during the roundtable, we planned out all four worlds, mm-hmm, and had, you know, plotted out the progression of all the items and weapons and all that kind of stuff. So, and our intention was to try to make all four worlds.
Like, and the items and weapons being like the keys and the torch and all that.
The in-game items.
Yeah, that's so hard to explain.
The in-game.
Yeah, we still haven't come up with good lingo for that, actually. I guess SAP specific.
Cool.
There you go.
I want to rewind a bit because I really want to get an idea of how the whole process works. So you're at week 3. You finished your prepping, essentially. What's the next step from there? That was step 1. What's step 2?
Okay, so step 2 was we've got our solid design, mm-hmm, we've got our design document, our plans, we've built not a functioning level at all, but we have little kind of stage platforms of, you know, here's an area of a forest here's sort of a field, and here's where you start, the lobby and all that kind of stuff,
right?
And so the next step was, okay, well, let's make the first zone. And
right.
That's where we started.
How long does that take, usually? How long did it take for you, and how long does it usually take?
It varied because there wasn't like a point where we said, okay, the aesthetic is completely established and set in stone and everything's figured out. Now right. go, right? It was an ongoing process of, you know, showing it to Daniel, showing it to Dave B, saying, does this work for you? You know, and then making the gameplay function with that.
Making it work.
Yeah. So I'm sure
the
first zone probably took maybe 2 months to really get that hammered to the point where we were like, okay, this feels like a product that we're happy to go forward with.
And does that include publishing stages, or is that just straight up just building it out took the 2 months?
That was all the building it, the scripting it, going back and forth on the aesthetics, you know, rebuilding the mountains several times, redoing the textures several times. And a lot of that was also dealing with, because we changed so many things with the player skills and everything.
Right.
You know, we shrunk them down and we don't actually speed you up, but we make it so whenever you get into combat, you get a speed boost so that you effectively don't slow down. And then initially we had the bounce pads in the first zone and stuff like that. So there was a lot of just figuring out all these systems, you know, getting the programmers help and Lisa figuring out from her end how to actually hook all that stuff up. So it was there were a lot of things converging.
Right.
And to do the second zone was half the time, and then the third zone was probably a quarter of the time, just because we had hashed out most of that stuff by that point.
Along the same lines, like you were talking about, like having to rebuild the mountains numerous times and stuff, like, did you find it harder or easier to like model around this, these retro graphics and stuff?
At first it was super hard, like I said, establishing something that everyone was happy with. And once we had it, it's super fast. So, I mean, you know, they're right angles and, you know, really
nice.
Simple textures and stuff.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure like initially you're just looking at just the texture, not on anything. You're like, okay, that looks good. And then, you know, you get in game and standing in front of it with like a regular, you know, Guild Wars character model or just a certain lighting. You're just like, oh, this doesn't look good at all. You need to work on this.
Yeah. There was definitely a lot of that. And I mean, making pixel art is an art in and of itself.
Right.
And then making pixel art that works in a 3D environment is another layer of art on itself. And then making it all communicate a coherent tone and, you know, work with the gameplay is another layer on top of that. So it seems like such an easy, you know, because it looks so simplistic and cartoony and obvious, like we should just be able to pound it out. But it was actually a really in-depth process.
What were your, like, would you mind enlightening us into how that worked out? Like, especially like with textures, that does sound like it should be easy. What were your major hurdles? What were your stumbling blocks?
Well, at first it was deciding how pixely we wanted to go. I mean, we've even experimented with using triangle pixels, you know, to give it more of an Asura holographic thing or whatever.
Yeah.
And mixing in like a little bit of photograph, so it still had some kind of realistic rock or grass texture or something like that. And just the more we pushed it towards the straight up, you know, homage 8-bit look, the more cohesive everything became. The specific difficulty after we achieved, you know, after we decided, okay, just straight up, you know, 64 by 64 pixel rock texture or grass texture, was then, okay, we're putting this over a cliff face that's essentially 200 feet long. You know, how does that work? And tiling is definitely something you see in 8-bit games, and it's not something we were specifically saying, okay, we you know, in regular Guild Wars, we try to avoid tiling by putting decals over things and having, you know, very complex shaders that let you do all sorts of tricks. And with this, it was kind of like, well, we don't want to use super fancy shaders, but we also, it gets really monotonous when you see the same thing in a 3D environment where you can look down a hallway, right? It's not just on a screen where it's tiled 8 times. You could potentially see it tiled 30 times.
Yeah.
And so that was kind of tricky. And then figuring out the ambiguities of, like, does this look like bark or does it look like snake skin? Or does it look like...
Nice. I mean, those two materials are very, very similar, so I can understand the confusion.
Especially when
you're working with 64 by 64 pixels. It's an interesting process.
That is cool. All right, so that was your 2 month stretch. Was that kind of like when you were done? Because you like submit it and play it at 2 months. Or what else? What happened after you'd built it out? Like, was there a QA? That to be QA, right?
Yeah, we got our embedded QA guy. Mm-hmm. Probably around that point.
Right.
And I think that's around the point, you know, when we've had the first zone, I probably don't have all the dates right. I mean, everything mushed together.
Yeah.
We were all working a lot of hours just because we were really passionate about it and just wanted to. I think at that point was when, you know, we had serious conversations about, okay, this is going to be a real project. This is your real, you know, ship date. Mm-hmm. This is how you fit into the rest of Guild Wars, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Go ahead.
I can't remember where I was going, so go ahead.
No, I was going to say, like, because, like, the whole turnaround time for this, would it be, like, the whole 3 months? Like, were you essentially, did you start and finish in 3 months? Or, like, what kind of...
For all of Super Adventure Box?
Oh, no, just for how much you've released in that first wave round.
Gosh, it's actually really hard to remember. I feel like it was more like 4 or 5 months from the from when I first went into base camp.
Yeah, like the last thing, as far as I know you're working on, is just after the interview you talked about the Christmas stuff,
right?
Like you did the town, which again, that's very cool for like inside the airship. Like, was it after that you maybe did like, you know, the holiday break and all that, but then started working on Super Adventure Box in the sandbox area? What was it? Base camp.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how it happened.
So it was like,
that's closer to 4 months, I'd say.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, cool. So would you say like what I really want is a mad scoop about what else you're working with, but obviously you can't give us that. But like, how many teams are currently in, base camp at the moment? Could you say?
Well, base camp is its own separate entity.
Right.
There's 4 Living World teams, of which we're going to be a part of once we start up again. A week after we shipped, we were kind of, our Super Adventure Box team was scattered off to deal with, you know, game-wide bugs and other content and stuff like that. Currently I'm working on the June team.
Right.
Living World team. And then next month is when we'll all get back together and start on Super Adventure Box World 2.
I guess a question to ask is, when we last talked, you were, ArenaNet had still trying to dial down the right time it takes, or like the right time to develop stuff versus like quality of releasing. So it's like, do you want to do a 1 month, you know, speed rush to get Halloween out, or like 4 to 5 months to get, like, you know, it's whatever content out. There still teams that are still working sort of like 4 months or longer for content we have yet to see? Or has Arena more or less dialed down what they want for time to release?
Well, we have a variety of teams working on a variety of length of, you know, we've got people that are working on stuff that's not going to be released for, maybe a year, I don't know. And we have people working on the Living World teams where we have several months usually to get that stuff out.
So it really is like an R&D madhouse of people like just working on these ideas, like making them into something awesome.
I like to think it's a controlled madhouse. Yeah.
Because like we had a discussion, I think it was either last week or the week before, about how we as players like to experience content in Guild Wars 2. And there's essentially like 2 main camps of that. Like, one camp was firmly like, yeah, we want new content every month. But me and Durin, I think it was, and maybe even Nubram as well, were more along the lines of, we want to see something as like polished and awesome as Super Adventure Box, like once every 2 to 3 months. And we're fine with waiting like that extended period of time for something that just has more quality or more work that went into it. It was more like a self-contained kind of experience. What are your thoughts on that? Like, where does ArenaNet stand on that kind of...
I think we stand on both. I think, like I said, we have teams that are on a variety of wavelengths, like different cadences. So
you're kind of like trying to do both as best as you can.
Yeah, right? So, I mean, there's a certain percent of the player base that will just completely lose interest if there's not some interesting new thing popping up every couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And then there's people like you that are more about, you know, the long-term sort of big picture.
Right.
So, and we need both of those people.
Because I've seen a lot of people that, especially with the Flame and Frost stuff being roughly once a month, even if they only stay on for maybe the 3 or 4 days after it comes out, they're coming back every month. If they don't have anything for, say, 4 or 5 months, they might have lost interest to the point where they won't bother.
Yeah, exactly.
And is Arena still, like, experimenting with release schedules, or are you going to try to commit to, like, because currently it has been one thing a month so far. Are you guys trying to stick to that, or are you guys experimenting still?
I think in general, I mean, what Colin said about it is, you know, basically we're trying to be, okay, I'm totally paraphrasing here, but what I got from it was that we're trying to be very agile in how we respond to the response we're getting from the players, basically. You know, what feels good to you guys? What, you know, is this too hectic? Is this, you know, not polished enough? Is it not the right kind of experience? I mean, because this sort of thing has never been done before. There's never been an MMO where the full time, the company is just working on constant stream of content for free. So it's a new world for everyone, player base and developers.
Cool.
Interesting.
I guess what I'm saying is it doesn't make sense to, like, say, this is our strategy, this is set in stone, we're absolutely doing this.
Yeah.
And, you know, there will be no dissent. It's really just feeling it out.
Nice. That's pretty much answered a lot of my questions right there. So I think one of the other discussions we had in that same episode, which is our discussion as to how rapid we wanted our content to come to us, or what we preferred there. One of the discussions that came up was, so why did Super Adventure Box have to go away? Like, why was it there for only a month and then go away for a while? Can you elaborate as to what the thoughts were behind that?
Yeah, I mean, right now the strategy we're trying out is this kind of cyclical events that come and go, so that when people have a sense of, you know, they're going about their daily life. I'm hopped into Guild Wars in a couple of days or a couple of weeks. Let's see what new is happening now.
Right.
And I mean, there's also just the logistical issue of, if you keep adding content and leaving it in, your player base just continues to fragment and splinter, and, you know, creates the sense of an empty world.
Okay. Okay, so
that's actually a really good point.
That's kind of a follow-up question to that, then. I don't know if this is something you can really say or not, but is the intention kind of in-game for Super Adventure Box to, once all the worlds are released, to be out for good, or do you still plan on, after World 4, pulling it away again?
I don't know. We haven't talked about that.
Cool.
Okay.
Fragmenting the player base is a good point, because I didn't even think of that. Because now, I guess, with the Molten Facility being the thing, everyone's doing that as opposed to having people going, hey, do we want to do Super Adventure Box, or do we want to do Molten Facility? And say you only have a group of like 6 or 7 people, you're split. So you can't really form like a full group for either.
Yeah, it's something that we learned as a company with Guild Wars 1 is we released, you know, crazy amounts of new content, new maps all the time. And that's exactly what happened. Was it's like a gas in a container, right? The bigger you make the container, the less gassy it is.
Yeah.
Just an idea, and I'm sure it's been brought up for like the maybe discussions, or it will be brought up when you guys talk about it. Maybe, like, because the one thing I always – like sell people on for a Super Adventure Box, it was the best April Fool's joke in that it was a real thing. when you have all the 4 worlds completed, it just comes as the holiday event for April Fools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could totally see something like that happening. I don't know.
Cool. So part of my This all comes from that one discussion. We actually, I don't remember when we did this, but we actually talked about this for an extended period of time. Was for Super Adventure Box, kind of the coolest thing about it is it has an internal progression system. Like, you get those baubles, you spend them on stuff, you get stuff. And, like, how do you guys, like, really focus in on that? Was that part of your design doc, or did that kind of, like, come in as, like, a happy coincidence?
Well, we knew early on we needed to have external rewards, mm-hmm. and it, you know, weapon skins seemed like the first obvious thing.
Right.
And, you know, my first obvious idea was, you know, the Minecraft pixel sword or whatever. And
yep.
that was quickly, the kibosh was put on that, because it breaks people's immersion. Aesthetically, that was the second biggest hurdle for us, was making everyone, and of course, everyone's never going to be happy, right? But
yeah.
as many people as possible feel like, okay, this is an item that could really exist inside of Tyria, that this, you know, a Surin inventor created this holographic technology and he made weapons out of it. This is what they would look like, right?
Yeah.
And that's so cool. They went through many iterations before they got there.
Because, so, like, you guys had those bauble, like, those digitized weapons and stuff, and the Fractals has Ascended gear, and both are kind of internal progression systems in that you do this specific piece of content to get a resource related to that specific content to then spend on something that's permanent related to your character. What do you think of focusing on those internal progression systems versus just, like, for example, giving you gold or whatever?
Mm-hmm. I think that's just not my field of expertise.
Right.
So I kind of, you know, I let the people who understand that stuff make those decisions.
Cool.
All right. I'm going to, I'll do one final question, but I want to move on because we are about like 45 minutes into part one, and we got two more sections to go.
Yep.
But I guess one last question is, with World 1 at least, no, it was World 2 with the Dark Forest. As soon as, like, you entered it, the environment, like, the lighting became dim and you couldn't see far enough, and, like, the world changed and for, like, feel wise mm-hmm. quickly ending as soon as you got out of it. But was that in any way shaped by, like, us talking about how awesome we love the environment lighting?
Yeah, it was your idea, and we're sending you a check.
Wait, I didn't get a check.
No, it's in the mail. So,
oh, okay.
Nice. Oh, okay.
That came about because, again, Zelda, specifically, a really cool thing to me about the second Zelda game, Adventure of Link, is that you will get to this cave that you have to go through in pitch black. And later you get the candle, and then you go back and you're like, I'm completely empowered now. Right?
Yep.
So I wanted to get kind of that, but we're in 3D again, which has all sorts of limitations. I couldn't put you in pitch black without a candle, because you literally could never find your way out. So instead it was just fairly dark. Right. And by World 2, we'll have areas that we can make, you know, completely black, because right. you have to have the candle by then.
Yeah, not to mention, like, an issue you would have, at least with World 1, like, with World 1, with World 2, it's going to be easier because everyone has candles, but it's great when you're by yourself playing a, like, Legends of Zelda style thing, but when you have a group of five people and one guy doesn't know where he's going.
Yeah.
Trying to explain to him or track him down, it could be very arduous.
I'm sorry, Thurp. I didn't really mean to get lost that many times.
It's okay. Since I'm the host, I'll ask last silly question.
I've boiled my questions into three staccato questions. Can I do those?
Okay, go for it.
You had like six quick questions.
Okay, all right. This is quick. Josh Foreman, which is your favorite Zelda and why?
The first one, because that's the first one I played and I grew up on it.
Nice. All right. Cool.
Acceptable answer.
Question the second.
I'm just so happy he didn't say Majora's Mask. The second question was, time traveler question. If you were to work with one of the makers of the games which inspired Super Adventure Box, who would it be, and why?
Miyamoto for sure. I'd have to learn Japanese, but I mean, he was the biggest impact on my childhood. Like, him and George Lucas are pretty much, that's who I am.
Aww.
You're George Lucas, excuse me?
I'm the unholy offspring.
Why'd you sell Star Wars to
the '80s?
Why'd you sell Star Wars to Disney, sad face?
No, that was
the
best.
Did you sign my picture, my giant poster of Jar Jar Binks? I'm his biggest fan.
And finally,
my biggest fan.
Third question, please, Cynic.
What's your favorite element of Super Adventure Box and why?
The hidden stuff. I love making hidden areas, and there will be much more to come.
Awesome.
Yay. Fourth quick shot question. Do you have a metric for how many times that guy's cart got broken? If so, how many?
No.
No.
Oh,
he lost count.
Best.
All right. I guess moving on to the second section, we just have some general environment questions with the Guild Wars world proper. But starting off, just how difficult was it to make changes to live content, I guess, from a logistics standpoint? The best example I can give is, I don't know if you've played World versus World as Red Team. In the Red Yak's Ben Keep, there is a chunk of stairs that is very visibly, like, not able to walk on, and just this, like, cube that you can, like, be floating in 10 feet off the air on the stairs. And it's just like, why is this here? So on the line of trying to make changes with the living story, like, you added that whole zone in Wayfarer Foothills. What kind of issues do you run against when you're trying to add stuff to existing content?
I'm almost certain there's a lot of considerations that the World Be World environment artists have to deal with that we in Guild Wars 2 PvE area don't have to deal with.
Yeah, like people sneaking over walls and cheating, basically. Yeah, I understand that area of it, but more along the lines of, is it not worth it to make that small fix because, like, you'd have to have the server capacity to have everyone in the game download that one map, and it isn't really worth it? Or is
I don't think that's it, because I think we're making changes and fixes all the time. Without knowing the specific issue, I couldn't really speak to it. I think in general, I mean, it's something that sounds that buggy would. How long has that been around?
Since beta.
I don't even know what you're talking about. What?
Yeah.
I'm referring to is Red Keep of the Overlook Hills Keep.
Is that
by the
north?
Jumping puzzle? Yeah, north.
Okay.
North. Just below the Lion Vista, where the portal that will soon be not important because they're making it its own map, but the portal to the jumping puzzle in Eternal Battlegrounds.
You can't jump up those stairs or walk up
those
stairs?
You have to walk on the right side, the left side there. You know what? We'll scrap that question.
Well, are we just deleting this? This never happened.
No. We're doing this live.
I'll edit it out.
That's fine. If you want to send me an email with coordinates, I will pass it along to the proper authority to fix that.
I'll send you just a Google picture of me just
because we're Red Team currently, and I was walking around there earlier, and I have no idea what you're talking about.
I have no idea.
All right. Well, I guess another question along the same lines of making changes to the world. Are you restricted to, like, do you guys plan on making improvements or continuing stories of worlds? Because something that I think you're very passionate about is, like, making a story evolve and continue. And are you restricted in that, like, oh, I'd like to make this house be destroyed by, like, you know, events. Let's say, like, you know, a charred, like, Flame Legion eventually destroy this town, but you can't destroy that town because there's a story mission that happens in there. So the town must always be pure. Like, it must always be standing. So, like, do you guys plan on making changes to the existing world? And if so, what sort of speed bumps have you come across?
I'm not sure about that specific case. I don't know that anyone's ever proposed, you know, bulldozing a town or mucking with areas where personal story quests happen. I know that we've talked about big, huge changing things, and like you're pointing out, there's just all sorts of logistics with it. You know, if there's a person who gets to play 2 hours a week and they have their next story step and they can't do it because that city's closed down or whatever, you know, I don't know. There's stuff like that. And then the bigger issue is coordinating all the changes between maps.
Right.
So Lion's Arch, which is kind of like my baby, gets the most revisions to it because most of the holidays and stuff happen there.
Right.
And it's always kind of a juggling act to say, okay, so, you know, Halloween has their decorations up And then, oh, wait, there's a bug in Troll's End I have to fix. But now I have to fix it in two different maps, right? And kind of having that mother map that holds the, you know, everything in. It's complicated and weird. It's kind of like a multiverse situation.
Sort of related to Thurv's question regarding dynamic events, without actually removing existing events, do you think there's really space for more completely new events to happen in the existing game as it currently is without having it feel too cluttery?
I think there's still, yeah, there's still spaces for it. I mean, like for jumping puzzles and stuff, we're adding, you know, I'm adding one for June. Mm-hmm. That's fairly large, and it's on what used to be a mountain range you couldn't get on.
Okay. So that was going to be a question I was going to ask is like, say, do you find it, because something that I guess you guys carried over from the first game, at least that I noticed, is that while the maps are much larger and now they're not just all instances, they all still sort of have roughly a squared off shape when it comes to the borders. So if there's not really room like in the middle to add a jumping puzzle, I was going to ask like, how difficult is it to maybe stick one around the edges, or is it just easier to just sort of, okay, we're going to stick this on a part of the map where you haven't been yet?
And yeah, there's a couple options we have. We can also basically tunnel down under the map and add caves and stuff like that under existing content. And
like in mountains. Yeah, that and
filling out corners and stuff is what we tend to do.
Well, maybe you can enlighten me on this, because I thought you couldn't do that, because for most maps that is, I guess it depends on the ranging of the terrain, but the water level is a set level. So like there's only so far down you can dig. If you're like choosing an area that is very elevated, that's wonderful, but there's like
most maps have a large enough range where there's plenty of between the water and the surface area to fill up.
Okay, very cool. I guess along the same lines of just jumping puzzles are awesome and like to see more of them, and it's great that we're seeing some in June. I recently had some friends join with the free weekend you did in April. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The first thing I love to show them is like when they visit Lion, start showing the Sharkmaw Cavern, because intro jumping puzzles, it's a really good one, and it's one that anybody can do because it's in a city. It's safe.
Yeah.
After that, it gets kind of hard of like, okay, I need to get a posse to escort you through this super hostile zone to do this jumping puzzle. And someone asked, do you guys plan on doing jumping puzzles in the cities? Like maybe one like human in Divinity's Reach, one going through the catacombs that were mentioned in the novels, or one where you're scaling the side of Ratasum. Once they mentioned it to me, I got to look on the map and like, whoa, there's actually a lot of places to put jumping puzzles. I wonder if they plan on doing that. So has it crossed your mind?
Yeah, it definitely has. I mean, I specifically made Sharkmaw as the Disneyland of jumping puzzles. And, you know, it's very much an introduction. And it's all thematic and everything. And putting other ones in cities is definitely, I'm almost sure it'll happen. You know, as different events and different Living World teams start branching out and start thinking of, you know, what are other interesting things we could do. Yeah, I'm sure that'll happen.
Okay, well, that's cool. I wasn't sure if like, no, we're planning on doing like other stuff with those areas instead. And it's like, we can't talk about it. Lots of things we could theorize, and wanted to get your opinion on that. One last topic, I guess, and then we'll move on to Shinboy's questions. I love the Super Adventure Box and like the guild puzzles, which we've just found out about from our guild. We're finally catching up to everyone else. They are awesome. But one thing that worried me about it was it's like it's this awesome mini dungeon that is more or less gated. It's only certain guilds can do it, or you can only do it on certain times when the gate has been lifted and the event has been activated. And I can understand like wanting to put that gated material there, and I'm all for guild puzzles, but does this more or less rule out the idea of doing mini dungeons in the world, similar to
can't think of the name of it, but they're like the frog one in Caledon Forest, or the only Zool in Lorna's Pass, where you're fighting waves upon waves of destroyers getting through this dungeon area. That's actually a jumping puzzle, I think, but it's still really combat.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, do you guys plan on ruling out mini dungeons, or will we be seeing less and less of them as we see more and more guild puzzles that are really highly polished mini dungeons?
No, I think mini dungeons are a really good option for Living World teams to consider, you know, because, I mean, basically we're told you need to fill up this month with content, come up with interesting ideas, and, you know, make it, several teams have done dungeons, you know, like the one that just came out. And and we're also told, hey, having some stuff that sticks around in the world is great. And so that's certainly going to be on people's radars. For instance, the jumping puzzle I'm doing in June, that's going to stay in the world.
Oh, cool.
So
forever.
Yeah, I think we'll be seeing more of those, not less.
Is it something that you is making a jumping puzzle easier because it's just like one level designer working in a spare time, or like do the mini dungeons require more work because you're having to set up traps, place mobs?
They're kind of on a spectrum. Like, there's some jumping puzzles that have hardly any scripting or content, right? It's just here's a difficult series of jumps, and then there's ones that are full of traps and mobs and all that stuff. So a mini dungeon like the one I did with Lisa in Range, the underwater, you know, where you unfreeze the sword by pulling the chain, that kind of stuff. That's not significantly harder than a typical jumping puzzle. So,
okay, very cool. I was curious about the development process of that. That more or less covers my line of environment questions. Unless anybody has anything else, we can move on to Shinboys.
If it's an environment question specifically.
Yeah, please.
When I was doing the fractals a while ago, a long time ago, I guess now, but there was one level which is the you're walking up, there's a giant on the side of the mountain. I keep forgetting. Does that have a name specifically?
Cliffside is the name of the fractal.
So for Cliffside, yeah. I'm terrible at jumping puzzles, which is why I prefer infantile mode. But at one point I fell through that world, and then I was watching this on screen. I wasn't recording it, so I don't have footage of it. But I then fell through another world, and then I fell onto a plain of flowers with mountains in the distance.
This sounds like something we should see in Injustice.
And that was it. It was just my dead corpse there, and I couldn't map out because I didn't think I was able to bring up the. Oh no!
You found Elysium. Good job.
What? What's is that Elysium?
No, I'm joking. Sounds like a bug.
Mind you, this was months ago. This was what, November, right after Fractals came
out. Oh, I was just wondering if there's like if that was supposed to be there, because that was weird. And I so wish I'd taken some screenshots.
I'll ask the map artist about it.
Did you jokingly add a Valhalla looking place at the bottom if people fell off the edge?
Yeah. Before we move on, I do have one quick question, which is a lot of the new content we've been seeing has been in instant zones of like outside of a little bit of the Flame and Frost stuff. Like the major content pieces have been inside instant zone. And as like an environment designer, do you see any advantages or disadvantages when you're creating something in an instant zone compared to something you're creating in the actual world? Like, are there some difficulties you obviously would come across while making that instant zone than you would, you know, crafting the existing world?
Give me an example.
I guess an example is the Super Adventure Box would be an extreme example because there would be no way. It would be extremely hard to implement that into the in-game world. But something like, I guess, dungeons that we're seeing recently with the Flame and Frost things.
Would be like not so much the dungeon, but I guess in the North of Wayfarer, there's Braum, I think. Yeah, like his instance is sort of it's on the map, but it's sort of an instance area.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah,
where,
so would it be
where
to make
Box
it?
Takes you into the hatchery and
Yeah, that's another good example.
Plateau, yeah. I don't think there's a significant difference except that with fewer players, we have a little more resources to work with. As far as, you know, polygons, we can jam on the screen and stuff like that.
Okay.
Cool.
Makes sense, because that way if you're going to be, okay, this is going to be for this specific, you know, storyline, want to make it as, I guess, fleshed out as you can.
Right.
So that we don't have to worry about, you know, hundreds of people storming in and crazy frame rate issues and everything like
right.
that.
Right.
Yeah.
There's no giant.
Is there any, like, the server side stuff that you have to worry about when it comes to stuff like Super Venture Box and other instances? Like, do you only have so much server space or anything like that?
There's definitely technical concerns. I mean, I think I brought this up last time when we made the Mad King Clock Tower. I was under the impression everyone would be able to play it solo, and that wasn't true. I think what happens is we let the server team know several months ahead of time what we're planning, and they tell us what can be done and what can't be done. And they can kind of jigger stuff around to make room for certain things at certain times. I don't know all the technicalities.
Yeah. And that was like one of the crazy things, because I was actually wanting to go into Super Venture Box with just me and Noob, because we hadn't done before and we had to actually rope
we'd
in a
just
guys.
Get lost and then we'd quit. That's
well,
what
was,
would
yeah,
happen.
But
why would you ever think that's a good idea?
Well, because we had to rope in dudes who hadn't who had already done it before us, and they had to do it that's in true. Infantile mode with us.
And I still got lost.
And you still
got lost. How great of a gamer I am.
So you needed more pointing fingers?
Yes, I need someone to... there needs to be a follow command that I can always press, and it goes to my nearest party member.
It goes to the nearest cloud that...
You know, yes, the nearest teleports me, in fact.
Oh, man.
Or just put, like, the Skyrim arrow in
oh,
the
yeah.
so the noob can never get lost.
Were those clouds supposed to look like they were pooping out the rainbow, or was that just, like... Are they in fact pooping out the rainbow, or?
We went through a couple ideations of them where, you know, do we want them to vomit the rainbow? Do we want them to?
Oh.
I think what we ended up with was the best. It the little kind of a struggle and squeeze.
Yeah. That's great.
Man, they look souped when they're doing that. They are so excited.
They're so happy.
Yep.
Very awesome. Well, now we'll move on to the, I guess, last segment of really just out there questions. We didn't really know where to place these. So, yeah. Shinboy, you want
to start off? The one that I have marked first, I'm going to ask last because we will have time for it. And that's a good final question, I think. Anyway, the first one is from Wooden Potatoes. Everyone on the show seems to know who he is, but for listeners at home, he runs a highly entertaining and fairly popular Guild Wars 2 YouTube channel. I had some correspondence with him regarding our last show. So before this one, I asked him if he had any questions that he would like to ask.
Yeah, he's actually pretty popular among the developers, too.
Cool.
There you go.
Is he bigger than us, Shinboy?
Probably. Yes, he's probably. Multiples of
I'm
our
I'm guessing
size.
Yes. he's a bit more cleaned up than we are.
That's
yeah, he asked this question, and when he asked me this question, you'll see it in a little while, but I didn't know this existed even until he mentioned it. But Josh, you apparently mentioned
specific.
That there's a little gold coin you can see in Lion's Arch near the trading post, which I believe has your little insignia on it. And what Wooden Potatoes wanted to know was obviously shows that you guys want players to explore and go out of the way. And if they do, there are cool things there for them to find. And he wanted to know if you can elaborate on exactly how many of those coins are out there. Because what he mentioned to me was that he would like to do a big community event where he goes, okay, there's, you know, say 10 of these coins, go find them all and come back to me. And then you win a prize or whoever finds them all.
How many coins?
I wish I knew. Yeah, that was something that I put into just little nooks and crannies or places where I felt like most of the time there would be a world out bug, right? And I would say, wow, that's really cool that you can get up there. And I would fix the bug, but still allow you to get up to some weird, awkward place. And I just wanted to say, kind of put a little note on there and say, hey, that's cool. I'm glad you got here, guys. Yeah, so I wouldn't say it's a reward, but it's more like some kind of communication from the developer to the player saying, you know, hey, you're cool.
Nice.
I don't think there's more than like 3 or 4, and I honestly can't remember where they are.
Okay.
Let's see what he does with that.
For the earlier discussion of...
Oh, sorry, I wish I could give you more.
Well, no, it's for the earlier discussion of, like, do you choose, like, the explorer, like, do you cater to the explorable crowd or the crowd that wants the reward? You are sort of a catering to the group that likes to explore, and the reward is finding that little tidbit that lets them know they're like the like, hey, you found a connection with the developer. He knows you were here, and that's kind of awesome, I think.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it.
Because honestly, until he mentioned it to me in that question, I didn't even know that the coin in Lion's Arch even existed.
Yeah.
Right.
So I have to go try and find it.
Right.
Okay, let's see.
There you go, wooden potatoes. How about
yeah,
those?
There you go.
Potatoes.
Oh, Vern. I hate you.
And anyway, moving on. Blitz, he is a member of our guild as well as the Giant Bomb forums. And he wanted to know if – I'll try and reword it because it's kind of confusing wording. Have you ever had an issue where you couldn't fit an event in due to either like engine limitations or restrictions on how you design the open world or anything like that? Like did the design ever limit the content, or did the content ever limit the design or anything like that?
Yeah, that's the canvas that game developers paint on, right? You're always running into limitations and figuring out how do we create the kind of experiences you want to given the limitations we have. And, you know, like I brought up with Super Adventure Box, I mean, that whole idea came about because I found a way to, you know, get around the limitations of having a giant open environment. You know, there's still a lot of them intrinsic with having from 1 to 5 players, and so there's all those other limitations to deal with. But it's a different kind of experience that we're able to create. And so basically every different kind of flavor that we can get into Guild Wars 2 has its pluses and minuses that, you know, you just deal with as a developer.
Right.
Okay, because I guess his follow-up to that would be, you mentioned like sort of getting rid of limitations by sort of zoning things off and all of that. He was wondering if there was any way, just for him personally, if there was any way you could fit like sort of like a multi-event sort of horde mode into like one of the guild missions or something like that, where you might have to design its own environment, but because you're designing its own environment, you could sort of, I don't know how to phrase this, sort of add more game modes to the open world as opposed to just a normal defend event or escort event or something like that.
Yeah. Okay. So because we have our living world teams, like I was talking about before, and they're kind of given, you know, a blank check and said, you know, fill this up with something interesting. We're always exploring those avenues, and we're so much more familiar now with the tool set that we have and with the ramifications of the decisions we made, you know, 5 years ago.
Right.
And so we're able to make better decisions now. We're able to build on what worked really well. And so finding different facets, different avenues of creating unique experiences, that's what we're going to be doing over the next however many years.
Cool.
Okay. That's interesting.
Kind of vague, but I mean, it's kind of a vague question, right? It's like, will we make more new, interesting things? And the answer is yes.
Okay. And it seems like the way you described it, that you guys have sort of figured out a way to make an environment to fit those things into, which is good.
Yeah.
Shinboy, okay, I have a couple questions before we get to the joke questions. So,
can I just ask the one that says bonus, because we do have time?
Oh, yeah, no, we have plenty of time, so just go ahead.
Okay.
We have another 3 days.
Exactly. You had mentioned before about how like your pixely sword idea got shot down. And I was wondering if in any game, whether it be Guild Wars 2 or any other, or the original Guild Wars or any other games you've worked on, if there was anything that you sort of like poured your heart and soul into and just sort of got it shot down because of that reason, oh, it doesn't fit in our world or anything like that, and you were just totally bummed that you love this thing, but it wouldn't work.
Every now and then. Most of the time, when you're just brainstorming and you have a random idea, you kind of get a sense for if it's going to fit in the, you know, the biosphere of the game experience. There's one particular one that happened a long time ago when I was working on Descent 3, and I had this idea for these alien catacombs that you would fly through with these kind of mummified alien corpses in niches along the walls, and alien ghosts basically would be the enemy. I can't even remember all the details, but you know, I was so excited about it and wanted to make it, and no one liked the idea, and they said no. It's just, that's not our game.
That is the exact kind of answer I was looking for. So, Cynic, you had another question before we get to the ultimatum question?
I have a couple. I also think we should do the inverse Q&A like we did last time.
Okay.
So, all right. My first question was, so, Josh, you were obviously around during the betas. Do you remember the Hunger Games event?
Yeah.
So, when we played that, and I bet we could probably go back to some of the podcasts we did around then. That was one of the coolest things that we saw ever. I'd say the only things that are up there would be Super Adventure Box and some of, like, the Snowblind Fractal are as good as...
I remember the first time playing that.
So that just, like, are the upper echelons of what we've experienced in Guild Wars 2, whether that says good things or bad. But are there any more plans for, like, events like that? Just crazy, almost, like, Doom, Total Conversion-esque stuff to do in short durations for Guild Wars 2? Because that was amazing.
I can't say anything specific, but I can tell you for sure that Hunger Games' idea has not been forgotten. And that
I can just feel Regina's glare just staring us all down through the internet.
I guess another way to word it is
doing a Hunger Games thing. I'm just saying that lots of people loved it, and lots of people would like to revisit it. And you know, happens will happen. We don't know.
Sometime along the road, Guild Wars 2 will have an event. That is what he's saying.
Maybe have an event. No, because that's kind of like it was one along the lines of many events Arena has held in the past. Like, for example, at the end of the Guild Wars 1 betas, you had the whole thing with enemies attacking people whilst they were in Lion's Arch and they couldn't fight back. And stuff like that, which are just like crazy world events that are... like, because our understanding was back when that Hunger Games thing was done, apparently like there was some dev interviews at the time, which was like, you guys only spent like 2 days or so and so forth making that event. It just like strikes me as such a cool opportunity for stuff to put into, especially in along the lines of giving players a reason to return on a monthly basis. Are there any plans for like other events like that kind of stuff, or like is that something you guys are looking at?
You're talking about two different things. I mean, the world ending ones where it's like, okay, we're about to shut down the server because beta's over. You know, that's just kind of a no brainer. Well, how are we going to kick everyone out? Let's do it with some kind of style, right?
Okay,
right.
And that, so no, I mean, we can't just kill everyone randomly anymore.
Oh man, that would be the best.
That would be the best.
It's almost like that. It's almost like in movies, you see, like, you know, they make the excellent line, or they do, like, you know, they know the right time to punch the bad guy. But in real life, if you make that line, there's the really awkward time after that when it's like, when the credits would normally be rolling, that's when you guys are staring at each other and he's like, you have to walk away.
But that would be really cool. Like, being at, like, near the end of a dungeon and then, like, a developer comes into a dungeon and just kills you. I'd love to see stuff like that.
But even, like, alternative stuff, which would be, like, in some areas of the game, there aren't any particular story stuff that I can remember. Like, what's that? Harathi Hinterlands. Is there any story stuff there, Shinboy, that I know of?
There's, in terms of personal story, not that I went through, but there's that really neat meta event up north,
right? But I just like there's no cross the story
stuff. Struggle against Centaur and humans, and Centaur will always push you back.
Yeah, but like there's that. I actually agree that stuff is pretty cool. But because there's no cross the story stuff, though, there is like a opportunity for that area to be used in like, okay, for this month or no, for this like 2 week period, we will have a reimagining of that zombie apocalypse event. Which you did, guys, during the Vitas, which was freaking awesome with the whole taking over and players becoming enemies.
Oh, yes. And then, like, if you get attacked by a centaur, you become a centaur and you, like, grow. Is that what you're trying to say? Or am I just
anything.
Messing it up?
It doesn't really matter. It's like crazy events like that to happen again, like beta equivalent events to happen again in these comparatively unused or underused areas.
I guess another way to word it is with the Karka event, you guys definitely understood that it's there is going to be some requirements for server stability and all that, and maybe not the best way to do giant open world combat.
Right.
But possibly in future Living Story events, you guys might bring out some sort of zone-wide event to help out. Like, that is something that is on the table.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
But specifically, I want crazy. Like, off the wall.
You can't always have crazy sim.
You're too crazy. You need to be put on a leash.
But we can't have crazy questions, but I guess before we do that, do we want to do the reverse QA?
Yeah, I can only tell you that the amount of craziness that we're officially allowed to do is 73. So.
we require over 9,000 craziness. I'm
is sorry. That metric or imperial?
Definitely imperial.
Oh. Come on. Oh, this is the U.S.
Oh, no.
Okay.
All right, Thurbs.
Okay.
Only for me.
You can take the reins back.
All right. I guess before we do silly questions, do you have any questions that you want to ask us?
Let's see. What did I ask last time? I think I just asked, like, what was a good experience that you had in the game?
Yeah.
Well, I guess since we're going forward with another world for Super Adventure Box, like, what kind of old tropes from old games would you guys like to see? What was cool about the first one? What you'd like to see going forward to the second?
Are you planning to stick within the platformer genre, or do you guys want to branch out into, like, RPG and stuff?
We're action and we're like platform adventure, right? Okay. So Mario meets Zelda is kind of where we're at.
I guess I'll start off. It's something that some people will probably groan upon hearing, but I, as a kid, I like the Legends of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, like the whole Pong battle back and forth, both in the Forest Temple and at the very end when you fight Ganon. It would be kind of cool if the players had to, like, get in a circle or at least get, like, you know, spread out some. Mm-hmm. It would be dependent on if you're by yourself or with a full group. But you have to do this whole boomerang fight with, like, the Frog King's prince or some boss. But, like, that would be a cool thing. And then, like, you're constantly having to look back and forth to see where the hot potato's at.
Mm-hmm. Good answer.
There already is something similar to that. If you go to in the Human Star Zone, and there's that one heart, the renowned heart, where you have to, like, train with the troops. If you pick up the shield, there's the NPC who sort of jumps around, and you have to wait for him to jump at you and time your block. So that could sort of, I guess I could see how that would work in that sort of setting.
Yeah.
I mean, you have all the players get around in a circle, and you have to, you know, bounce the ball back at a certain time. That could be interesting.
For me, okay. You kind of hit the nail on the head of it when you started that sentence. Temples. God damn it. Like, what? It's hard because puzzle solving is really difficult in team circumstances. Like, Zelda wouldn't work as a multiplayer game, I don't think. But
I don't know. They made one.
Yeah,
they made the Four Swords Adventure.
Yeah, did it work?
Yeah. Like, so, are you guys planning to do like group like a temple, a group puzzle solving kind of thing?
Well, our last world is Castle, and that's going to kind of be most of the temple-oriented tropes.
Right.
Wait, was Four Swords the one where you hooked the four GBAs up to the GameCube? Is that how?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Just want to make sure I had the right one in mind.
The one that nobody played.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a hard design challenge to make something that's engaging for one to, you know, four players, or in our case, one to five players.
Right.
There are crazy amounts of weird just design logic that has to go on.
Yeah. And the other would be like mini bosses, right? Like, that's another huge element of Zelda. I know that there was stuff at the end of each like subsection for 1-1 for Super Adventure Box, but I didn't remember
the bee dog queen.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, those were mini bosses for World 1. We'll have more engaging ones.
Yeah, I was going to say, because like the whole thing about Zelda is like you get the X implement and you use that to beat the next boss, and I can't wait to see what you do with that going forward. It's gonna be cool,
I guess. It with all, like, did you guys plan, like, look into anything with like Mega Man, like the way the jump system works with that of moving platforms, or is that still something that is like not possible with the current engine of Guild Wars 2?
It's something that we're looking into and trying to figure out how much we can get away with.
I've suggested two things. Come on, guys.
Okay, I'll go with one. since we touched on it earlier and you mentioned the castle and the dungeons, messing with the lighting more, because when you have, I guess, an indoor setting or at least partially indoor setting like a castle, you can sort of manipulate the lighting and the way things look much more so than you can with an outdoor thing where you're like, okay, it's either sunny or it's dark. That's about it. So I'd like to see, you know, messing with the lighting more.
I guess more character interaction, like humorous character interaction. I know, well, I know it's hard to like just randomly make stuff like that, but it is
rewarding.
Oh no, my cut. Yeah, for someone like, especially if you're just like a content tourist like me or Cynic, mm-hmm. and you're just going around seeing the content, it is especially rewarding to see, you know, a lot of that sort of funny stuff. Definitely keeps people coming back, I think.
The dialogue was some of the best stuff in Super Adventure Box, like easily.
Yeah.
Or the shopkeeper who didn't care when you threw stuff away.
Yeah, the best. So cool.
Oh, that was great. I was probably
really exercising my writing chops there. I was thinking back to how 8-bit characters talk to you and translate it. It's pretty fun. But we actually we had a lot of our English edited away though, sadly. But...
Oh no. Oh, that would have been perfect. Wait, was it deemed offensive or was it just like, oh, it's a bit much?
I'm not sure exactly. I mean the editors have their own code of you know what's acceptable inside Guild
ethics code,
and so getting back to the like things you can't put in the game sort of thing.
Yep.
You know, I created a Festivus poll. I don't know if any of you guys are familiar.
Oh yes,
I know what you're talking about.
Festivus for the rest of us, right?
Yeah, and you know, there's a little we made a little Asura that looks just like Frank Costanza. And I wrote some lines that were like just sideways enough where it, you know, it was lines from Seinfeld, but it was translated into, you know, what a Crichton, a Surin would say. And they it just didn't go.
The monsters.
Go. Yeah. It's a shame.
See,
you know, it's for a good cause. I mean, you can't have a game that's nothing but references to other things or you end up with Family Guy, the game, right?
Yeah. So,
I mean,
Borderlands 2.
Still. I want my Costanza Sura. I'm with Josh. I think Josh thinks the way I do when it comes to a little bit
now
crazy.
You have to make an Asura called Costanza Sura. It flows well as one word.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, Shinboy.
Oh, yes. Did you happen to, Josh, did you happen to nab the name Soiled Underplants at launch, or did you come up with that later?
I did get it at launch, yeah.
Because I saw that and I was like, oh man, that's a pretty good pun.
Worst.
All right,
worst.
New Brahma or Durin, you got any ideas?
The dialogue, I told you. God.
No. I'm sorry. I'm like trying to think of things, but honestly, like I was already kind of blown away when we found the warp fish. So
that was probably the best thing I could found.
The worm.
Was it worm? That's right, it was worm.
Yeah.
But yeah, like that was probably like the best, like, retro game callback I could have ever seen in this thing, so I'm pretty happy with what I've gotten already.
Konami code somehow.
No, I'm good. I think you guys are doing a really cool thing, and I bet what you are thinking of is probably more interesting than what we're thinking
yes.
of for that. So I totally can't wait.
All right.
Hence, if you don't get paid to make games.
Yep.
Now we delve into the dark part, dark section of just.
Well, really,
we're gonna start playing Dark Sector.
Josh, well,
I guess Josh, any other questions for us, sir, or?
No, that's good.
Wonderful. All right, now we just ask these really dumb questions.
Okay,
Josh.
I want to ask mine first. Okay.
These are like the personality part sections of applications.
Yeah, pretty much.
This is more of a reference question, I suppose. You worked on a game called Alter Echo. Also working on this game, I believe he was a gameplay programmer. That we all adore by the name of Brad Meir.
He is adorable, yeah.
What was it like working with Mr. Brad Meir?
It was good. He's a super awesome guy. He plays in a ska band, or at least he did when I worked with him.
Accurate.
And that was a good 5 years after ska was out, so I hope he's still... no, he's just a super chill, really nice guy. I love him.
He's Mr. Muir on MOOER on Twitter. So he's the best.
Yeah, because we we're the Giant Bomb. We're all members of the Giant Bomb community, and he is good friends with all those guys. So we see him all the time.
Yeah.
On videos and live shows and stuff. So we have all grown to love Brad Mir.
Also, I think they played the behind the scenes making of for Alter Echo on one of the live streams. And I think I'm pretty sure that was Josh Foreman.
It was actually like they played the credits.
The credits.
We saw your name on the credits. That's how we made the connection.
Right.
Oh, okay.
But wasn't he in that thing? I think he was in that video, wasn't
no,
he?
No, Brad Mir was in that thing.
Only Brad Mir and some other dudes? All right.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. Was that your question? All right.
Yes, because I would have remembered if we saw Alter Echo era Josh Foreman, and I would have linked that picture in the show notes.
But indeed.
Regardless of its quality.
Such a sad story, man. That game had so much promise and so many like cool, unique features for its time, and just completely botched by THQ. Oh,
you know what?
And now they're dead.
Honestly, it looked really interesting. Like when Brad, because they were playing it on the show while Brad was talking about
it. After THQ, it was like their THQ in memoriam thing,
yeah,
if I recall.
Yeah. And like it, like you said, like it looked like something that like definitely had a lot of promise to it and everything. So it's I was kind of sad because I had literally never heard of the game prior to that show.
Yep.
Yeah. It's like THQ did everything they could to sabotage its release. It's horror story after horror story, but. And well, and then they let us all go. But the thing that I think really kind of final nail in the coffin was just the art style was unapproachable. Like it was super unique and super interesting, and I love it. But no one could tell where they were or what they were doing.
That's possible.
It seems like it was good from an artistic standpoint. And it was certainly unique, but it seemed like it might have been a bit difficult to market. That's
yeah, well. It definitely was. Like, it didn't have, you know, you're in the warehouse now, or you're in the tower now, or you're in the forest. It was all just like, you're inside the guts of an alien planet the whole time.
Yeah.
Well, the whole planet is this plant thing that is sentient, and it makes sense. But yeah.
It's cool.
It was a cool design. But I guess moving on to Cynic's dumb question.
Yeah, my dumb question of this time around. All right, so when eating, is it specifically buffalo wings? Is that what we're settling on?
Or no, well, this all started with KFC.
Okay.
Was it KFC? KFC said they were going to do boneless stuff, and that's how this whole thing started.
Well, there you go. So when eating wings, there is two ways of eating them, of which one is correct. And the other one is sorely wasteful and horrible. If you were to choose, Josh Foreman, between chicken that had the bone still in it or boneless chicken for your wings, which would you choose?
I know it's the wrong answer, but it's the boneless.
Oh, no, that's the right answer! That's the right answer! Right.
Yes. Oh, it is?
Yeah.
Yes. Internet high five.
You're not a savage. Yeah.
Why would you want something that hard to eat? Like, I don't understand. You're trying to enjoy your food.
Exactly.
I can eat boneless chicken wings with a fork.
Yeah.
Like a civilized human being.
I can do other things while consuming that food. Yeah.
I use chopsticks, so it's okay for me.
Yeah, actually, food that I have to eat with my hands really annoys me because I'm always multitasking. And when I have to dedicate myself to eating, it's just an annoyance.
Mm-hmm. Also, I feel like there's like some sort of compulsive need to wash my hands before I eat with anything with my hands. And
smart idea to wash your hands before you stick your hands in your mouth.
Yeah.
Also, I can do things like put...
For me, it's more so a problem of like the compulsive need to wash my hands while I'm eating things with my hands.
That's true.
Oh, yeah. Like even if you clearly, it doesn't really matter. It feels gross having grease all over your hands.
But you can put, you can put things like boneless chicken in like between bread and do other stuff with it. So I like,
oh yeah.
Suddenly you have a sandwich.
Yeah, suddenly
you
have a sandwich.
Life has been improved.
Yeah, it's just so much better in every way. God, well done, sir. Josh Foreman.
Yes. You passed the team boneless test.
The giant bomb test.
We can cast seal of approval.
Yep. Is that it for the week? Are we done?
I have one really just grown one, but would you rather fight a duck-sized char or... No, would you rather fight a char-sized duck or 10 duck sized char.
Uh-huh.
Char sized duck.
Yep. Char have teeth.
Or 10 duck sized char.
7 foot tall duck. Or
man, that sounds frightening.
Yeah. Or 10 1 foot tall char.
Mind you, when I'm imagining the duck, I'm not imagining like an actual duck. I'm just imagining a giant like rubber ducky.
I can't think. Of
oh, like eight ducks. Tall. That would be terrible. I mean, ducks are pretty vicious.
Yeah, they are.
They can be mean.
Thing about their how they mate, it's terrible.
What? How? What's the thing about how they mate?
I don't know if we want to go down this road.
No, I want to know what's happening.
It's a dark road. I'll explain later.
I'll tell you what, Gerald.
Wikipedia.
Go to crack.com and type in duck, and you'll find it.
I'll tell you, Gerald.
Yeah, I would do the duck-sized char. Wait, how many of them are there?
Ten.
Ten. enough to like throw you on the ground, sort of thing.
Yeah.
And they put up a fight. Your jugular would be yeah.
I guess the char-sized duck.
Yeah. I would go for the char.
I think you're crazy. I think you can kick a small char like pretty hard. Like you can probably disable them with a kick.
Ankles and...
But that's the same with like rabid dogs.
According to modern science, basically like gremlins.
Yeah.
That is true. But according to modern science, he has picked the right choice because at that size, the duck's legs won't be able to hold itself.
Oh, come on. Get out of here.
That's what I'm counting on. Just
so it just legs crush. Noob Rama and Durin, do you guys have anything dumb to ask?
If you could own any THQ property, what would you own?
Ooh.
That's an awesome question.
As in like a game property?
Anything, really, yeah.
Not real estate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not real estate.
Any IP, I guess.
All the things that I keep thinking of, they don't actually own. I guess Red Faction. When I first started, I didn't work on Red Faction. The first one when they started making it was our sister company, Volition, but they were our sister company, so we shared news groups, so we were all buddy buddy, right? And when they first started it, they had something so cool going. And then they turned it into a linear first-person shooter, which completely like ruined their cool new tech.
Yeah,
all my memories are of playing the multiplayer of it, and then just like shooting a hole in a wall just like 50 mm-hmm. times, to making a hallway, and then just running through there instead of the hallway right next to it.
Or just camp in that hallway.
Yeah,
yeah.
That's like all my memories of Red Faction 2.
So that yeah, I would want to reboot Red Faction.
But they kind of did that with Gorilla, right? Josh. Gorilla was amazing.
Gorilla.
Yeah, oh, it was cool. I want to be able to dig down through the terrain.
Yeah, the problem with Gorilla, like, it was cool, but it took the idea of geomodding, and instead of actually, like, modifying the terrain, you were just able to destroy buildings. So, like, it'd be cool to maybe have all of that, to be able to destroy those buildings, but also be able to burn holes in the hammer. Yeah, exactly.
Very cool. Durin, do you have any question to round us out, or should we just go to plugs?
I think we can go to plugs. I think we have filled our quota of dumb questions.
Yep.
Very cool. All right. I guess starting off with Josh, how is that? Like, any other plug? Like, any plugs from you, or just keep plugging that project on YouTube? How's that going along?
Oh, it's still coming. I'm in the middle of making a 4 foot tall Colossus from Shadow of the Colossus.
Oh,
wow.
Awesome.
Any particular one?
Yeah, which did you choose?
Yeah, it's the sixth one, the Barba, the one with the big beard.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
Mm. I'm throwing my beard out at the same time that I'm sculpting it. I started in November, I think. And I still only have maybe 4 inches, maybe 3-4 inches of beard, so it's pretty sad. But yeah,
it was pretty impressive during the whatever that horrible internet song was that you rocked out with
the Harlem Shake video.
Harlem Shake. Oh, God.
That was terrible.
You being on there was the one bright moment of just like, oh, no, Renet's doing. Oh, wait, that's Josh Foreman. Yes.
I had not heard of that meme before. They were like, hey, let's all get together and do this thing. I was like, oh, it's a camera and I can be stupid in front of a camera. I'll do it.
Yay.
And then I found out it was. Whatever. Some people liked it. That's good.
It was pretty funny. I chuckled.
I'm bringing up that builder now.
Very cool.
As far as plugs, I don't have anything really new. The only thing I would have that people might enjoy checking out, just if they like Super Adventure Box and old school games, is they could check out some of my sculptures. I've been re-envisioning some of the original Zelda monsters and stuff. So you can check that out at scribe.deviantart.com. And the scribe is spelled with a Y, so it's scribe. deviantart.com.
I'll put that in the show notes. It'll be in the show notes.
Yeah. All right. Moving on to Shimboy.
I finished Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon, so probably tomorrow afternoon I pretty much don't have anything to do, so I will be writing up a review for that. And that'll go on my my blog, plugandplaygaming.com. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
When are you going back to Kingdom Hearts?
Now that, I don't know, because I really, there are no games coming out that I really feel like I need to play, and I'm probably not going to restart Mass Effect for a while, seeing as my save got botched, and I don't feel like replaying that beginning. So probably soon, unless you want to finish Saints Row the Third, because then we could do that.
Oh, right, we need to do that, yeah.
Just to be clear, Josh Foreman is a dude wearing the Zelda-themed t-shirt who is suggestively riding the guy with the horse mask.
That tells you all you need to know about this video, really.
They said he could do whatever he wanted.
Well,
as a secondary note, my other favorite thing about that video is, I believe it's on the left, there's a guy with like a YOLO hat on just shaking his head in shame.
Yeah, so that was Byron. He was our QA guy on Super Adventure Box.
Who was the guy wearing the char mask? The guy opened the video.
Oh, I don't even remember. It was whoever had the smallest head, because the mask shrank over the past year or whatever.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Man, this
sounds like a thing that shouldn't happen.
Yeah, that's weird. Cynic, do you have any plugs?
So there's a video with Josh Foreman in it, and I'm going to put it in the show notes. It's called Harlem Shake. I don't know. Something that happened a couple years ago, but you can see it there.
Please don't.
Oh, is that the Scything, the Korean dude?
No.
No.
Not at all.
Aside from that, not really. I could plug PlayStation Plus, which I'm looking at for. I'm really, really staring at it at the moment, because I found a 750 gig hard drive on my desk, essentially.
You know, just found. It just showed up.
Well, yeah. I just forgot about it, and now it's here, and I'm putting in my PS3 this afternoon. I might sign up for PlayStation Plus, because you can get Catherine. I mentioned that last week.
Sort of serious question. Does the PS3 take 3.5-inch drives or 2.5?
It's a laptop, so 2.5.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just curious. Yeah. That thing's not that big for a 3.5-inch drive.
Yeah, no, it's totally spaced that I had this hard drive, so now I can fit Infamous 2, so that'll be on there.
And that's New Rama, what plugs do you have?
Before I do my plug, so I go to sleep, Josh, I went to your channel to look up your video project real quick, and I found a popular video called Your Money or the Stairs, and I'm very curious on what this is about.
That was about, it's 9 years old at this point.
Yep,
man.
Yeah, so that's Tammy. She's another one of the environment artists here. And one of our coworkers got a new camera, and he was like, hey, you can take video. Check this out. So it's like, oh, okay, I got this idea. So that's what we did.
I'd suggest everyone to check this out. You should link this on the
in the show notes.
Oh yeah,
this is very extensive stuff.
Almost as if it were a plug.
Uh huh.
Yeah. Oh, wait,
Durin, do you have any plug? Oh, all right. Yeah.
Is this you flexing your pecs? Is that is that you?
I should.
Yeah,
hope so.
That was in response to someone that needed that.
Oh man, I might have to watch this video now.
It's so weird. It's so weird. Yeah, those are going to be all in the show notes.
PC Gaming Hub, we're all playing that gross Neverwinter game, except me. Come hang out with me. Add me on Facebook. Join the Facebook group.
Please don't join the Facebook group.
Don't join the Facebook group.
Yeah,
I gotta get on. Like, I've been reading my son a bunch of, who's the guy who writes all the Drizzt novels?
Oh, fuck. Yeah, I forgot his name. I know. That guy.
I know someone who would know that, but that person is not on the show.
Yeah. So yeah, my son's really interested in checking out that game.
Man,
Because he can be a dark elf. So cool.
R.A. Salvatore.
Yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah.
That name sounds familiar.
It does sound.
Wait, how old is your son? Is he...
You got two, don't you?
Yeah, it's my 13-year-old.
Okay, so that's fine. You could probably play online games as 13, right? Or is that something you'd probably frown upon?
No, that's fine.
Yeah, that's probably fine.
I remember getting bullied on the internet for having a high voice when I was 13.
You still get bullied on the internet for having a high voice. I still get bullied. And you're barely over 13.
Yeah.
Durin, what plugs do you have?
I don't know a specific time because Shinboy and I will have to sort that out, but I will totally be streaming us going through Saints Row the Third co-op.
Are we going to restart like from the beginning?
I don't know. We can.
Because we're at like varying points.
Yeah. Yeah, we can restart.
Okay. I'll pick the zombie
I feel
voice.
Guilty. I still haven't played that game, even though I have like 10 friends who worked on it.
That's true, because Volition.
A bunch of us from Outrage ended up there after THQ has closed us.
It's a really good game. Definitely recommend it.
Because like we were both like halfway through and sort of in like that game for us was in limbo of like, yeah, we'll get to it eventually. And then they announced Saints Row 4 and we're both just like, oh man, we should probably finish it.
Oh, burn. New Brahma with the
they now they released that that footage that I got to see at PAX. Nice.
Yeah, they did.
The other day.
Yeah, I guess that'll be my plug. I plugged the Twitch, but I mean the only game I'll be playing in the future apart from Guild Wars is like Metro Last Light, which it's an awesome game. I suggest people check it out, but it's kind of weird to stream a single player story game.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's at just giantbomb.com. It's a website about video games, sort of like IGN or something, but in a much more awesome way. Mm-hmm. Check it out.
Yeah, we really sold that. Resold that so hard. We
like to see heart and soul to it. See entertaining personalities play really dumb video games.
Yep.
Join the Pizza Gaming Hub. Landed at that.
Right. I want to say a huge thanks to Regina for helping us set this up. Is she still there?
She might be asleep.
Oh. I totally wanted to say hi on the show, but whatever. All right, cool.
Thank you, Josh Foreman, for coming back on the Linking Cast. I'm not sure why, but you're awesome.
Step two of our plan.
What? Yeah. The only thing I wish we'd asked is what movies and shit Josh has been watching recently.
Oh, we could just talk about that now.
Yeah. What have you been watching, Josh?
I think just the latest blockbusters, Iron Man 3, Oblivion.
How'd you like Iron Man?
I liked it. It was good.
Because I didn't like the first two.
I don't expect much out of superhero movies, so when I like them, I'm pleasantly surprised.
Nice. Yeah, I thought it was pretty much as good as the first one.
There's one thing I really liked about Iron Man, which these guys have all heard, but it was that, like, I haven't seen this done since The Matrix. The trailers for it, like, you saw Guy Pearce a little bit, but in every, like, the Mandarin was always the head bad guy.
Yeah.
And that, like, that being a big facade was awesome.
Yeah.
That was awesome. I really appreciate it.
Yesterday I just watched Star Trek, and the entire time you see, like, What's his face?
No spoil. That's not out yet. That's not out in the U.S.
What's his face? That guy? Guy?
Benedict Cumberbatch?
Cumberbatch. You see him as the main dude? He is the main dude. There's some crazy stuff with him. It's awesome.
Benedict Cumberbatch, the most British name of all time.
And he is fantastic in that movie. God damn. That movie's pretty good.
Awesome. Can't wait.
Yeah.
I just watched the last Star Trek movie again last weekend.
My dad and I were going to go see that because we went to go see The Hobbit together, and they had, an IMAX. They had the Star Trek Into Darkness preview.
Yeah, the first 10 minutes or whatever.
Yeah, and he was like, man, that looked really good. I should probably see the first one. And I was like, wait, what? Because him growing up, he was a big Star Trek fan. I'm like, you have not seen the first one? So we had to watch that recently.
Oh, man. For me, the first Star Trek movie, I felt like the first 10 minutes were like one of the best openings to a movie I've seen, like, ever. Because the whole, like, if you don't remember, it was the father Kirk, so the older Kirk,
yeah,
Tiberius, I think is his name, right? Sitting there, and he sacrifices the ship and himself to save the guys, like his crew. That was so good. And that guy went on to become Thor, and that's pretty cool too. So yeah, pretty happy.
And more importantly, the motorcycle guy from Cabin in the Woods.
Is he? No way.
Yeah.
Oh,
that was my favorite movie that year it came out. 2011?
Oh, Cabin in the Woods was so good, yeah.
Cabin was a Thor. I haven't seen it. Which are we talking about now? Oh, God.
The Cabin in the Woods.
But wasn't that Starring years ago? Let me have a look.
No, that's relative. Maybe in Australia where you get... We get movies late here in the US. You have to remember this.
No, it was 2011. Okay.
Yeah, sounds right.
You have to think, 2011 was a couple years ago, which is kind of crazy when you stop and think about it.
Yeah, that feels like forever ago.
Yeah, I think it came out almost exactly 2 years ago. It was an early spring release. Or mid... What are we now? I guess we're technically late spring?
Right.
Early summer?
No, it's not June yet.
I don't know how it is for you guys in Seattle, but Portland, it feels like it's getting near summer.
Yeah, actually, the Super Adventure Box team had a little reunion picnic where we went out to the park and played frisbee and stuff. It was nice.
Aww. Thurb, I cannot express my disappointment enough that you live in Portland and you have yet to go to a Portland Timbers match.
Sorry, I don't go to sports games.
Oh, it seems like so much fun. Like, they score, and they just set off green smoke and start revving up chainsaws, because why not?
I will go to a Portland Timbers game, okay?
Liar.
This
is this is a really great poster. If you hear a strange sound outside, have sex, Cabin in the Woods. It's the best. this is like one of those horror spoof movies, right?
No. I mean, it's not like a joke movie, but it kind of turns the horror stuff on its...
So it's like
let's put it this way. I don't like horror movies because I don't really like horror anything. Will I still enjoy this movie?
Yes, because it goes directions.
I don't like horror movies, but this was just so... It's more like the best episode of The X-Files that has ever been made.
Oh,
yeah, like you literally could not guess where this movie is going to go.
Okay, because like I am not a big fan of like your traditional slasher horror movie like at all.
This is not that.
Right, and it puts it in a kind of a sci-fi wrapper, like an explanation why those tropes exist. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have to see it; it's amazing.
Because is that?
It's like,
correct me if I'm wrong, but like in a trailer, at least there was like some extra room with like what looked like a whole bunch of government people or some crazy nonsense, but they flashed it for like a second.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's not even like a twist that's established at the very beginning.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Because it's in the trailer. So if like that's in the trailer and it goes crazier from there, or at least not, because that's not necessarily crazy, but it is different.
Mm-hmm.
Man,
so it seems interesting.
This is kind of cool. Yeah, I might check this out.
It's like just about every time you think you understand what's going on, the movie just goes a completely different direction.
Yeah, and at the end, it's so off the wall and it's insanity, but the best kind.
Awesome.
Okay. Josh, do you plan on going to PAX Prime this year? Either as ArenaNet or just as, it's an awesome convention that's in your town. Are you?
Yeah, not as ArenaNet. It depends on if my friends are going or not. I'm not sure what I'm going to be doing. I'm probably going to be crunching on something really important. So.
Okay. I just like, that's the next time I'll probably be up in town in Seattle. So,
Well, you should swing by the office again, and this time make sure it's when I'm here, and not in the meeting.
Okay. There's actually a...
Get your shit together.
You mentioned that you have a wall of like art, like of various art books and just reference material in your kitchen or study or something.
Yeah.
Actually, let me grab the...
Why do you know this?
Have you been
he said it on the last podcast.
Okay. All I know is that I went to PAX East and they had a whole bunch of art prints and there was a Guild Wars 2 on. And I was like, hey, I play that video game.
Nice.
Do you really?
I do. Unlike some people on this podcast.
Burn.
Oh, right. Therapy got you.
What's up? I had the headphones off.
No, it's cool. There was also one for Journey. And I love all things Journey. Both band and game.
Have you heard of Jim Thornburg? He's a photographer of rock climbers and just general landscape scenery.
No.
All right. There's a book that's pretty, it's just a bunch of rock climbers climbing, but it's in all sorts of areas that are Like similar to the discussion we had after the first podcast about just rocks and how like you guys have done.
Man, awesome you guys job. Talking about exciting things like rocks.
No, dude, rock climbing is fucking insane.
Oh, yeah,
climbing
is pretty insane. Rock climbing.
Okay, but more just like how rocks are actually this like whole thing and not just brown.
I have a design document of a game I will make at some point in my career that's going to be a rock climbing like race game.
Will it have Oculus Rift support?
Really wacky characters, but yeah, where I can just focus on making super legit, weathered, properly real mineral rock walls, and that'll be great.
Hey, Durin, if we can somehow finagle DM controls into that, I think we might have something.
What? I don't know. They're referencing something.
What just happened?